For a man who spent so long on intelligence operations to make such a basic mistake, it's pathetic. You were a Standartenfuhrer. You made decisions daily that destroyed lives, and yet you are so stupidly sentimental as to keep pictures about you to remind you of the past.
I am proud of what I have done for Germany. And what I have continued to do, may I remind you?
Not much longer. Those photographs were to fall into the hands of the German government.
Well, I will send instructions immediately. They are to be put in a more secure place.
Don't worry, I've already done that. They have been burned.
You've destroyed them?
All of them.
But there were pictures of my wife.
And pictures of you in uniform.
That was an evil act. I have no record left of Madeline.
Your record of Madeline could have destroyed us all. And our hopes for the future.
She was my wife. I loved her. I had to keep some reminder of her.
And endanger your comrades. It is now time for Dorf to disappear.
And Dorf Industries?
Will be taken care of without you.
Well-oiled and well-armed multinational group of elites that will cull, kill, and subjugate.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 5th of August, 2022. Speaking remotely, actually, from Herefordshire. Is that right, Martin?
I'm in Herefordshire, yeah.
And I'm in West London here, Tony speaking. So we're not live at the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol, but we are remote this week and possibly next week too over the holidays. And we're on the new talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the BCFM Politics Show app. So all you need to do is go into your app store. And if it isn't in there, then you're in the wrong app store. Or maybe the right app store, who knows. But anyway, you have to search around. It's there in Google Play, annoyingly. Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade Ukraine Psy War propaganda, and also, of course, still bits and pieces of COVID medical misinformation. An estimated 60,000 Brits died unnecessarily over those couple of years. Those London media lies now supposedly all forgotten about. Anyway, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week, in part one, we look at Dark Cloud. He's this guy, Native American, that's wound up in Bristol. Fascinating story. It's a little documentary that's been made about him in Bristol, about how he wound up in Bristol. And also the Bath Road Homes, the Marvin Rees Mayor's flagship affordable housing program collapsed last week. So we hear him talking about what a great scheme it is before, obviously, more recently, it hit the buffers. Also, Audrey White. She was kicked out of the Labour Party this week by Keir Starmer for confronting Keir Starmer live on some podcast or video, talking about why she believed that he'd lied about what he was going to do when he stood. So even though what she's saying is entirely factually correct, well, the Labour Party leader doesn't like it, so Starmer has removed her. Also, we'll be looking at Zionism during the Holocaust. This is Tony Greenstein's upcoming book, and also why and how he was being removed from PayPal for his work. Tony's the first Jew to be expelled from the Labour Party for anti-Semitism several years ago now. Also, it's Hiroshima Day. I'm not sure if it's today, but it's happening over this weekend. And we'll also be looking at the Amazon strike, the Dutch farmers, dairy farmers, what they have to say about why they're off. We've got, by the way, in the UK, the net zero contract being awarded to a tiny Cornish firm for allocating £50 billion of our money in zero carbon policy funding. One little in Falmouth. And no one really knows who this company is or what they're about. Prince Charles in trouble again, for this time for taking a million dollar donation from the Bin Laden family. In part two, Nancy Pelosi does her bit to try and start World War III, a bit of a mystery as to why she even felt the need to visit Taiwan, which isn't recognised diplomatically by Britain or the United States. We talked to the former British ambassador, Peter Ford, what he thinks about Nancy Pelosi's visit. And in a way, more seriously, we also look at the cancelled journalist Graham Phillips. He's been out in the Donbass, a British guy, reporting on what's been happening, the shelling in these breakaway republics by the Ukrainian army ever since the coup back in 2014. His first reports were in 2014-2015. And also the POW bloodbath. So a whole load of prisoners taken by the Russians then got blown to pieces. Was it the Russians? Was it the Ukrainians? Or was it the American M142 HIMARS rocket system that they've just delivered to the Ukrainian army? Tonight also something called Dialect on the Not the BCFM Politics Show. We haven't had Dialect for a while, but since it's the silly season, it's August, I thought we'd have a few little items, the sort of things that used to go on to Dialect, that is lighter things. Today we go and take a quick visit, as I did earlier this week, to the Spa Valley Railway at Tunbridge Wells. Tunbridge Wells famously, of course, being where Rishi Sunak gave that little speech shortly, not long ago, where he's now been called out for saying, well, I've managed to wangle it so that places like Tunbridge Wells get loads of funding and inner city Labour areas don't. What a great job he's been doing as Chancellor to impoverish the poor even further. I suppose this is part of his glorious levelling down agenda, isn't it? And to wind up, Yuval Noah Harari, we hear from Zev Zelenko again. We heard from him a few weeks ago, but here's just the specific clip about Yuval Noah Harari and who is he? So that's a pretty packed show to fit into a couple of hours, Martin. Let's start with this documentary that's just out in Bristol about this guy called Dark Cloud. I have a listen to a little excerpt from that now.
My real name is Makeda Anaquad, and loosely translated in English, it means dark cloud. I was born December 15th, 1967, in Thunder Bay, Fort William. It's on the shores of Lake Superior, the biggest Great Lakes in Canada. In Canada, during the 1960s and the middle 1990s, the Canadian government, they went into all the reservations to kidnap all the children, and they put us in residential schooling. I was taken away from my people and my land when I was about 2 years old. In our communities and on the reserves and our land, we live completely different to the outside world. Like, for example, I could walk into your house, start eating the food, watch television, have a shower, play with toys. My parents, they wouldn't bat an eyelid. They wouldn't be worried, oh, where's Dark Cloud after school? It's because they know in our community that I'm being looked after, and it's just an attitude of whatever is yours is mine, and whatever mine is yours. White people also come in our reserves as well, and we don't mind because we consider everybody equal. And then the Canadian government, the social services come in with their fancy cars. They give us fancy toys and fancy candy and sweets and things like this to the little children. Say, come in, would you like to drive in our fancy car? And of course, we're children, we're naive, we're excited. We're like, yeah, we get to go in the car. How cool is this? So off we go, we're off in the car. And then that's it, we never return home. We're driven straight to a residential school. A residential school is where they strip us of our language. My first language is Algonquin, and our culture is the spiritual belief of the Great Spirit, Mwana Tenka, the Great White Buffalo, and the medicine wheel are three examples of some of our cultural heritage that they stripped away from us. They put upon us Christianity. If you had brothers or sisters, which I did, I had two sisters, they'll separate us and they'll put us up for adoption by different families.
Well, that's an excerpt there from this rather harrowing documentary. And it's called, it's just called a short documentary, Dark Cloud. And he is a Bristol based now, but he's a victim of child kidnapping, Martin. The thing that really disgusts me about that is how they kind of frame this in this kind of Christian context. Of course, this isn't a Christian thing to do at all, taking kids away from their parents, indoctrinating them. And it's only the extreme versions of religions, all different faiths, might do this if they're extremists, but the faith is not about that. Anyway, the main question here has got to be, This sort of thing is still going on, isn't it? Where sometimes the fact that people are deprived, I'm thinking particularly here about the social, the cost of living crisis, then when parents are considered too poor, then sometimes the authorities will come in and take their kids away, saying you're too poor to look after your own kids. Now, that's the sort of excuse that was being used by the Canadian government to take Dark Cloud when he was just a nipper.
Well, I mean, obviously, child kidnapping of that sort happens all over the world, if you like. But it's very specific what we're talking about in Canada, because not only did they take these children to very oppressive children's homes to indoctrinate them as to be, you know, mainstream Christian Canadians, as it were, but also lots of people died, and they found lots of mass graves of kids who'd been ill-treated that they died. And the Pope, in fact, has just visited Canada, to apologize, supposedly a pilgrimage of repentance, to apologize for the existence of these. They were largely religious institutions, many of them Catholic. And of course, you know, it's a scandal which is, we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg all these years later.
What about this thing he mentions about giving sweets to kids to tempt them into the car and take them away? This sounds incredibly creepy. This sort of stuff going on, you know, around about the year 1970.
Well, I haven't seen the film, so I don't know the detail of how he was, kidnapped, as it were. All I know is the general background of this stuff coming out. And, there's been quite a lot of revelations about this recently in the media in Canada. And it's a major scandal over there.
It's also led, hasn't it, to there being various parts of Canada. I think it was in Vancouver. There was actually a legal challenge to the Crown by Indigenous people saying, well, actually, all this land you say you own, you don't. It's always been ours.
Well, that's obviously an issue in Canada and in the United States and many other parts of the world.
It's pretty cheeky, really, because when the British came in there, they said, well, you are a pagan country. We are Christians. The earth is God's. And so the Queen or the King, it was Queen, actually, was it probably Victoria, says that this is now God's earth. And so we are in control of it for you, you know, and for God. Now, of course, those ideas about God are sort of disappearing and we don't make those claims so much anymore. And so really, it is only fair that the land is handed back to the Indigenous people.
Well, that's undoubtedly the argument that they will make. And of course, you could argue that the whole of Australia should be handed back to the Indigenous people of Australia. That's not going to happen. But in both countries, there's considerable pressure for something to be done to redress the injustices of the past. Well, same in New Zealand.
Marbo and Wick, yeah, in New Zealand. I think actually it may be Australia too.
All of these countries have got this issue to confront, haven't they?
They certainly have, where certain legal judgments, promises, etc., made by stateswomen in favour of the Indigenous. But one of the things I loved about what he said there was they took our land. Now, you know, this, of course, is key, isn't it? Because if you don't have land, you don't have the ability to build a home. You don't have the ability to build a workshop, to make a living, to find somewhere rent free to do that. And actually, what we're going to talk about next, which is this whole thing about economic growth and the economy, the more things that people have to pay for, whether it be land, water, all those things that come naturally with the land, apparently this is good for economic growth and it looks great on the figures.
Well, I mean, the GDP is simply a measure of everything that's been bought or sold in an economy over a year. So it can involve anything at all. And of course, even big disasters can increase GDP because you have to spend loads of money on cleaning them up. So therefore, they show up as increases in GDP.
My point is that if you're pretty much self-sufficient, self-sustaining, you're very bad for GDP because you're not spending enough to buy the water you need to drink, which, you know, would otherwise be gurgling out from under your nose. And also, of course, to pay rent for somewhere to live when your community, as his was, it has their own reservation.
Well, you know, some countries are on paper extremely poor, but the quality of life is relatively high because they get all they get, you know, they basically get the priorities right. You know, I'm thinking of Kerala in southern India, for example, has long been seen as an exemplary in this respect. But they had to have a big land reform there in the 1940s. You know, these things don't just happen.
OK, so the film is Dark Cloud. The film is Dark Cloud, a short documentary. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And we will obviously be talking about the economy, what with the big hike in interest rates, the 50 percentile points, I think they call it. But before that, we heard last week about the collapse of the Bath Road housing scheme, financial collapse, that is to say, thankfully, not the buildings falling down. But the trouble is, this is one of the Mayor Marvin Rees in Bristol's flagship shows, as he spelt out. Not shows, schemes. It's an affordable housing scheme. A lot of people have been criticising the Mayor Marvin Rees, supposedly Labour mayor, saying, well, all your housing you're building in Bristol is totally unaffordable. So this is the one he's been pointing to, saying, well, this is affordable housing. Anyway, last week, the whole thing went bust. So I think let's go back to March this year, just after the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians, where Marvin Rees, the mayor, was on Politics West chatting to a guy. I think his name's Nigel Horlock, who runs a scaffolding firm, talking about the whole situation of housing in Bristol, where Marvin Rees cites Bath Road scheme, that one that's just collapsed, as a glowing example.
The rent is too high in Bristol for people
that's
to be able to
problems.
Live. There's an average of probably £800 to £900 a month. Mm. You know, it's people can't afford it, and they can't, and they definitely can't afford to buy housing. And this is the poor states we live in, and it's just making it worse. It's made the gap bigger between rich and poor.
But that's one of the reasons, if you see the conversations with us and you see the cranes up, it's one of the reasons we're building houses. If you go down Bath Road, you'll see that block going up just opposite the fruit market. That's 100% affordable.
And then what you need
to
do...
affordable?
Well, social rent. We're not talking about 80% of market. That's part rent, part buy. Okay. So people can buy, and then it's they're built to rent, but that's with a housing association. Right. But we, you know, our drive now to build tens of thousands of homes in the city, the whole Temple Quarter development that we're looking at, you know,
that's all well and good, but what you need to start doing with that these builds within Bristol is use people within Bristol and not let the richer companies have the monopoly of the builds, because the smaller companies are not getting a chance in. Using companies from London to come and build in Bristol, it needs to be kept in Bristol.
So that is the Mayor Marvin Rees talking to Nigel Horlock. Martin, it's a bit embarrassing, isn't it, when a massive scheme like this just falls apart? And it was up until last week the great flagship scheme that says, well, actually, these are affordable housing, even though, of course, many people say affordable housing is nothing of the sort.
Well, I don't know all the detail about this. Of course, we knew that the scheme.
I can tell you all you need to know, which is that this is the number one affordable.
Yes, I got all of that, Tony. Yeah, but
it's just gone bust.
Yes, well, that may well happen for an awful lot of other things, because we're probably going into a 2-year recession, which will probably end the construction industry doing anything at all.
Isn't the implication of this that the mayor is urinating in the wind, because actually you need to sell your houses at far higher rate. We were talking about this last week. You need to sell your houses for more than it says on the books of the business plan for these projects in order to actually turn a profit nowadays. And if you're... It is as the economic situation changes, so something that looks like a viable scheme 3 or 4 years ago suddenly isn't anymore. And that, I'm afraid, is and what we may well see is, as particularly as this place has already pretty much been finished, it's been built, is that this won't be affordable at all. They'll be sold at market rents now.
That's quite likely. And the problem is that local councils in the 1950s and 1960s had the right and the duty to provide council housing, which wasn't done by any private sector developers at all. The councils did it all, and there was no possibility of them going bust, and they could just do it. They've not been able to do that since 1979, when the Tories brought in their rules about what councils could and couldn't do. And of course, what you've got with Marvin Rees and many other mayors and other leaders in local government around the country is they say they're going to try and solve the housing crisis, but they haven't got the tools. They're they're not allowed to do what they used to do in the 50s and 60s. And of course, that's the result of all of that, is that we've got this massive housing crisis. And of course, the housing crisis spills into the cost of living crisis, because the main cost that people have is the rent. And that can't afford, and you've got to pay that, because otherwise you're in the street, and then you've got no money for food, etc.
Wrong about that, because the councils do have the tools. And Paul Smith, who is in charge of housing, is someone you know very well.
Yes.
He resigned from the council because he just simply couldn't get on with the job. He wasn't being allowed to by the top officers at the council and the mayor himself.
All right. I still stand by what I said, Tony. If you actually look at the rule book, which wasn't changed during 13 years of Labour government, councils are not allowed to go around building council houses. They used to just be allowed to do it. They've got to bring in social housing developers, even if they're going to do social affordable housing. Now, in the past, there was none of that. The council built the houses. That was it. And of course, that's all been destroyed by the Thatcherite era. And of course, the consequences of that are the grandchildren of people alive at that time will never live in decent housing.
In a bigger backdrop to all of this, we've got Andrew Bailey, the new governor of the Bank of England, took over from Mark Carney, now in charge. He's upped interest rates yesterday by 0.5%. That's what they call 50 percentile points. And this is what he has to say about it. A very big inflation shock, Martin.
It is, of course, a very challenging situation. We're facing a very big shock to inflation. And unfortunately, in the last 3 months since we last did a forecast and a monetary policy report, that challenge has got much bigger. It's coming from predominantly and overwhelmingly from one source, which is energy pricing and particularly gas prices. And I'm afraid it is coming from the actions of Russia.
Martin?
Well, it is to do with the energy prices rising, but that is to do with the sanctions that have been placed on Russia by the West. And they say, well, we've got to have sanctions on them because. But if they didn't have sanctions on Russia, there wouldn't be an energy crisis to the extent that there is. It's pretty ridiculous, really. It's, you know,
it's Russia.
It's not Russia. Russia is offering to provide long-term contracts, which were signed a long time ago, to provide gas into the Western market. But they've been told that they can't, that they've said you've got to pay in rubles because you've impounded all of our foreign assets.
Anyway, Andrew Bailey says, this is all about our second clip now, putting up rates to prevent long-term inflation.
Now, our concern is that, of course, we have to bring inflation back down to target from a very high level. Now, other things equal, we think it will come down. The question for us is, are other things going to be equal? And that really is about the question of, is inflation going to be persistent and become embedded? Mm-hmm. Now, we do see risks on that front, and that's why we've acted. And the risks are, and this is where there is a domestic element to the story. We've had a shrinkage in the domestic labour force over the last 2 years or so, during the COVID period. And so when I go around the country talking to firms, as I do a lot, yeah, they are still saying to me two things, really. One, we're struggling to hire people. Two, actually, we can set, we can increase prices. Mm-hmm. We're not hitting resistance on increasing prices. Now, we understand, obviously, the situation, but it concerns us because that's one way in which inflation can become more embedded. Mm-hmm. And then we would have to raise interest rates by more than otherwise. Mm-hmm. So our action today was very, very clearly, we feel we've got to take stronger action, as we said we would, because we changed the language of our sort of, in a sense, forward view back in June to say that if we saw this evidence of persistence, we'd act forcefully, and that's what we've done.
So what do you make of that, Martin?
Well, I mean, what he's saying there is, I mean, don't forget, the remit of the Bank of England is to keep inflation below 2%. And it was set, you know, when the bank became independent during when Brown was the Chancellor, when people used to believe that basically most of the problems of capitalism had been solved. It was basically a functional system, and all you needed was a kind of hand on the tiller Bank of England to tweak interest rates to keep it all straight.
Martin, 13% is heading for now. They're not doing very well, are they?
Well, that's because, in actual fact, capitalism isn't a stable system, as presumed behind the idea of having an independent central bank, which can just tweak interest rates to keep everything steady. because in actual fact, things like the 2008 crisis were predictable and were predicted by economists like Steve Keen and so on. But the mainstream didn't want to know about it. Now we're coming back to what you might call the real world, where inflation can go up for all sorts of reasons far higher than you'd like. But you can't. I mean, what will happen if they're not careful is they just crash the economy. And that may get rid of the inflation, but it's only through the mechanism of making a lot of people at the bottom end of society a lot poorer. And of course, that we've been through several cycles like that, and we're just about to go through another one.
Yeah, he says he's struggling.
There is no easy answer.
He says he's struggling. Well, I think there may be by doing nationalisation on a large scale, and actually by printing money and spending it in the right places. I mean,
you might be right. But that is actually extremely radical policy. More radical than the Labour Party.
It's just common sense. Corbyn.
And of course, it may come to that. You're quite right. But in the short run, most people think that they're still in Kansas, and that if ultimately, you know, things will come back to normal.
He says, Martin, as well. I mean, he says he's struggling. They're struggling. Companies tell him they're struggling to hire people. Well, isn't this simply because the cost of living in Britain is just way over the top? It's an enormous bubble. It's been fueled by privatisation, and it's also now being fueled by these massive, unlimited, it seems, increases in energy costs, even though the wholesale markets aren't increasing at all. It's just the profits that are going up, as we've seen this week with the energy companies once more making record profits.
Well, I mean, that is an absolute case why these companies should have been in the public sector all along. And of course, what's happened over the many years is people got used to the idea that basically the economy's got to be private because it's got to be, even though our great grandparents or grandparents knew very well that you don't run an economy like that. It's not an efficient way to run it. The shortage of labour is partly to do with COVID, and it's partly to do with Brexit. And of course, even with a shortage of labour, we've still got falling real wages. So there's no danger whatsoever of wages getting out of control here. None whatsoever. But what you could do is you've got profit taking, you know, basically by monopolies. You could tax that and give it to the poor. And that is obviously what you should do.
Even
the mainstream has got that.
The windfall tax. Yeah. Anyway, so... we're going to hear, I think, probably four clips altogether from Andrew Bailey. The next one is we're hearing, and maybe before we hear it, it'd be interesting to get your take on what he's about to tell us. He's saying actually that the Bank of England has a bit of a peculiar relationship with the markets, whether or not these decisions are actually market driven. So before we hear from Andrew Bailey, Martin, what do you think? He's saying, well, the market is starting to bet on whether the economy is going up or down. And so we take a certain amount of notice of that when we're deciding what to do ourselves.
Well, yes, it's a tricky game that they're playing. The markets want them to raise interest rates because that suits the market, but it might not be in the interests of the country as a whole. So the Bank of England, although nominally independent and nominally not a private institution, tends to do what the market wants.
That's the next question, isn't it? How independent? He's about to say, oh yeah, well, we don't necessarily follow the markets, we're independent. How independent are they really before we hear from him?
Well, I think that is a myth. They're not as dependent on the markets as the Federal Reserve in the United States, which is essentially privately owned, but ultimately they're part of the same infrastructure. You know, that the City of London has captured the Bank of England. And that doesn't mean that the Bank of England sometimes doesn't do things that they don't like, but by and large, they don't. And they've got a very narrow way of thinking about things. I mean, it may well be, you see, because they've got to get to 2% inflation, because that's by law what they've got to do. And of course, Liz Truss is suggesting that maybe they should be taken back under the wing of the government. Because until the Bank of England was made independent, the policy was decided by the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
That's right.
And what you could easily have now is the Chancellor of the Exchequer pushing in one direction and the Bank of England pushing in another.
That can be not necessarily
a good idea.
It was Labour's Gordon Brown that let them off the leash, wasn't it?
Well, it was done all over the world.
Done in Britain, Martin.
It was done in Britain by Gordon Brown, but independent central banks were being set up all over the world at that time, because that was the demand of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And of course, Britain is one of the powerful countries that pushed this idea, independent central banks. And if you're going to push it on everybody
What I'm saying here is that actually, although we, you know, always point the finger at the Tories as being responsible for all this stuff, actually, Labour was too. I got the impression that Brown You know, he also said, didn't he?
The Tories would have created an independent central bank as well. It was pressure coming from the IMF.
He had delusions about this. He said, "I saved the world in 2008." And then,
that was after the creation of the independence. Yeah, of the Bank of England.
Let's have a listen now to Andrew Bailey, governor of the Bank of England, talking about how he is independent of the market. He's the Bank of England market driven.
The market assumes that you will go for, let's say, another 150 basis points worth of hikes over the course of this hiking cycle, but then start cutting interest rates. What do you make of the argument that the Bank of England have to hike now in this small window before the economy starts turning south?
Well, we take our decisions based on the evidence that we see now. So, you know, it's not a sort of case of us sitting down saying, gosh, if we don't do it now, yeah, we're not going to be able to do it in the future. I mean, our decisions are entirely based on what we see today. Now, you're right about the profile of the market. Now, look, we do not, you know, endorse the market curve. We use the market curve as a conditioning tool for our forecast, but it doesn't mean to say we endorse it. So I'm not going to give a commentary on where we think policy is going to go relative to where the market thinks it's going to go. I think it's interesting, as you say, that the market, and it's not just, of course, our curve, actually, you can see it in other curves as well, other countries, thinks that we're sort of going to go up and come down again. And again, without wishing to endorse in any sense, I think the rationale, I think, behind the market thinking that is they think you're going to have to act more aggressively early on. But you may actually have to go above what would be the equilibrium level, if you like, and then come down again to sort of get inflation out of the system. And I can understand why the market, you know, thinks that that could be the way we go. I'm not endorsing that, but I can understand why. I mean, it's interesting if you go back in time, because I think people would have said, well, that's a policy mistake. And I think the rationale and the thinking in the market now is not so much it's a mistake, but actually it's a path that would deal with expectations, you know, get expectations under control, and then you can bring rates down. Now, we're not endorsing that path, but I think it's an interesting way in which the market has evolved.
Well, the funny thing is, that's exactly what he said he was doing before, you know, sort of having quite a strong increase in interest rates to send a very strong market a signal to the markets, Martin, isn't it? And now he's saying, oh, we don't endorse that.
Well, because he doesn't want speculators to pick up on his words and run with them. He's basically hedging his bets, and that's why that's central bank speak. Yeah, they don't necessarily say exactly what they think. In other words, they want to keep the markets guessing. So if they decide to raise rates, they don't necessarily want the markets to know what they're going to do. They're under a lot of pressure to raise rates because the consensus amongst the mainstream economists is that inflation's taking hold, inflationary expectations are taking hold, and therefore they're going to have to increase interest rates in order to control that, because that's the only mechanism they've got, really, because they've given up on fiscal policy years ago. And of course, the problem is it may just crash the whole economy, because the economy, in fact, is cooling as we speak, not just the British economy, the global economy. And if everybody raises rates simultaneously to try and get rid of inflation, and that the real problem is that the system, underlying system, capitalist system, is in a crisis. You get too much inflation because the system isn't working properly. You then raise interest rates to get rid of the inflation, and you don't solve the problem. What you do is create a deflationary problem where nobody's got any money and everybody's pushed into bankruptcy. And in lots of developing countries, Sri Lanka was only the first domino. Over the summer, lots of developing countries are going to default on their debts, quite rightly in a way, because they've got to decide, as Michael Hudson's pointed out, whether they want to have their own people looked after or whether they're going to pay dollar-denominated debts back into the Western financial system, which they're never going to pay off. And in actual fact, they don't really owe.
Good point. Anyway, let's get away from the official line and onto the radical line, I suppose you would say, and have a listen to Steve Keen. He was on Press TV last night talking about this very topic and reacting to Andrew Bailey's decision and giving us his explanation of what's really going on.
A recession to last until next year, which you can tell us the definition would be 5 consecutive quarters of a contraction, each quarter to be 3 months in duration. Tell us more about that and how the Bank of England can be so sure into the future that the UK is going to be experiencing this recession.
Did you say 5 quarters then? Is it 5 quarters of negative growth?
Is that okay. Isn't that what it is until next year?
Well, that's the length of time. The usual, like the informal definition of a recession is two consecutive negative quarters. To get five is a serious recession. So I think it's quite feasible that these sorts of falls are going to occur because we've had two major forces that kept the economy ticking during COVID. One was enormous government deficits, which generate an identical private sector surplus, giving people money to spend, which they did, which is why the recession was so short-lived. Now the government's talking about trying to balance its books, which is a stupid thing for the government to be focusing upon. But if they do reduce the size of the deficit, they also reduce the amount of money they're injecting into private bank accounts. People have less money, and there's a downturn there. And then with higher interest rates, which are now passing through to mortgages, credit cards, and so on, that higher cost of money is going to discourage people from taking out credit. So rather than credit going very strongly, as it did also during the COVID boom, we could now see credit turning negative. And that's what caused the Great Recession or the global financial crisis back in 2008. So we're going to get potentially a double whammy of a government-induced recession from high rates and from cutting back on its spending, on top of a private sector one caused by a reduction in credit. The low-income earners in the UK, I don't know how they survive, frankly. Given my own background, I was earning about £90,000 a year when I was in London, which it ended up being £4,000 a month, and half of that went in my accommodation, and the remainder had to go on living. And I found it challenging compared to the same income back in Australia, where I was quite comfortable. I know first-year teachers, first-year nurses, first-year firemen, and so on, are on wages between £20,000 and £25,000 a year. Now, they can't even imagine living in London, and the costs for them in the rest of the country were already high. Trebling the cost of energy is going to mean for a lot of those people they will not be able to afford energy, and they will therefore have to consider things like wearing, gloves inside their own homes to avoid freezing during winter. And they certainly can't do anything to fight the increase in temperature when you get the enormous temperatures that are coming through courtesy of global warming now. England recording 40 degrees, which is literally unheard of in its historic record. So they're going to suffer very badly. And I think there's going to be an enormous amount of angst out of this and lots of strike action over it, but very little chance to change the direction of the government policy and very little chance to increase their wages as well.
Why not? Why wouldn't the government change its policy?
The government has been following the wrong policy for 40 years. It's very unlikely to wake up, oh dear, we've been doing it wrongly, let's do it the right way now. They still think the government should be behaving like a household and trying to save money every year. Now, the government is not a household. No other household that I know of has the right to create money, but the government does. So if the government creates money, that money turns up in our bank accounts, and that requires the government to run a deficit. Now, the English government has been obsessed by running a surplus, looking at the accounting of the economy from just their point of view and thinking if they pay a surplus, they can pay their debt down, and they see that as responsible. But because what happens with the government is the mirror image of what happens with the non-government, if the government runs a surplus of $1 trillion, the private sector runs a deficit of $1 trillion. We're not talking about numbers that high, but fundamentally it's a seesaw. One's up, the other's down. The average is zero. So if the government is trying to save money, it's causing the private sector to dissave. Now, they've been doing that nonetheless for 40 years. They still haven't woken up. I really have no confidence that they will ever wake up over this. So they're doing the wrong thing, and yet they think you're doing the right thing. Humans' capacity to self-delude cannot be underestimated.
Uh-huh. So the lesson I'm learning from you here, and hopefully the viewers, is that the government shouldn't have a surplus because that money should actually be flowing into the people, average people, to take out and spend into the economy. So having a surplus is not great idea. Okay.
There are basically three major factors that are coming together all at once. One is that we have pushed, we've ignored the warnings of the limits to growth in 50 years ago and continued pushing our energy consumption. So now we're consuming probably four times as much as we were back in 1972. And that means we've exhausted cheap oil. We're now exhausting even unconventional oil. So the cost of energy is rising, and that's inevitably going to continue happening. We, at the same time, we have had a a period of extended low inflation courtesy of globalization. So particularly American corporations, but also UK corporations, have outsourced manufacturing to China, which reduced costs dramatically for a long, long time, but also made the manufacturing sector very fragile because there's an enormous supply chain. And if that gets disrupted at any point, then costs rise. And of course, COVID has dramatically disrupted the supply chain, particularly from China. Then we have this period of ongoing austerity by governments where they falsely believe they should save money. But rather than saving money, what they're doing is creating not enough money, and therefore the economy grows more slowly because of a lack of government of money for turnover. So those three factors are all coming together at once. And the most important one, I think, for the long term is a rising cost of production. And in that situation, if you want to squeeze inflation out of the economy, there's only two other factors you can affect. You can reduce wages, which are already at trivial levels in the UK, or you can reduce the markups that firms put on their input costs. And that is something which the firms have resisted for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Now, the interest rates are likely to increase the cost of business, not reduce it. So I think the government is finding out how impotent it is now with the tools it's chosen to use.
Yeah. Steve Keen there, the economist who was at Kingston University for a while. I think he's not sure where he's gone now. Debunking Economics is his book. He's a sort of Michael Hudson for this show as well. A couple of really good economists, as along with Martin Summers, who's a PPE graduate. Yeah,
I'm not on their level.
Not quite, but no. But Martin, you do get most of this, don't you? In fact, you have also a slightly different take, I imagine, on Steve. But what he's saying at the end there is this hiking interest rates is going to increase the costs for businesses. It's going to be driving people out of business. It's one of the effects that the Bank of England, apparently, Andrew Bailey and his mega crew haven't noticed.
Yeah, but the idea that you've got to control inflation. My old economics tutor, Robert Mabro, said to me in my first year, he said, what you've got to recognise about inflation is that wealthy people don't like inflation, but in actual fact, for poorer people, it's not necessarily a bad thing, provided their wages rise in line with it. And there was the economy was run all over the West with a bias towards inflation. In other words, if there was a choice between having a bit more inflation or putting people out of work, governments generally erred on the side of having a bit of inflation. And in actual fact, most booms are associated with a rate of inflation. But of course, the free market textbook is that prices should just not move at all. They should just stay the same. And then that means that nest eggs and so on aren't undermined and all the rest of it. But of course, the bailouts in 2008 threw all the textbooks out of the window anyway. And of course, they're now in a situation like in Japan, where any attempt to cut government expenditure will simply fail because the economy starts to go down. And in actual fact, the deficit gets worse. That's exactly what happened to George Osborne. He tried to cut the deficit by cutting public expenditure, and he lost the country's AAA credit rating because the economy started to go down the drain. And when the economy goes down the drain, the deficit of the government naturally increases. So there is no way to cut the deficit. You have to actually go. It's like driving a car and you get onto an ice skid. If you've got to drive into it. Now, if the Bank of England wasn't independent, you could have a Chancellor, Rishi Sunak or whoever, making the decision, well, we're going to put up with a bit of inflation in the short run because we don't want to crash the economy here. But because the Bank of England has got a different remit to bring the inflation down to under 2%, whatever, and don't worry about anything else. The Federal Reserve in the US has got also a remit to maximise employment. But the Bank of England doesn't have that remit, nor does the European Central Bank. So they do what they say. Oh, well, if inflation's rising, we must press this button and raise interest rates. But what will happen is the economy will crash. And then the deficit will increase anyway, because loads of people will be on benefits. And they won't be paying taxes and so on.
Isn't it interesting that all this is happening at the same time as this housing project on Bath Road in Bristol has just hit the rocks?
Well, it's quite likely that's a canary in the coal mine, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. I think you're quite right. I think we need to just stick on the economy a little bit longer, Martin, because We've also got the potential that the, I mean, you know, what we're saying there is that, you know, it's okay having this inflation so long as wage rises go along with it. And that is what this whole autumn of discontent, summer of discontent, winter of discontent in 2022 with various strikes. We've also had, obviously, the rail workers is by far the biggest union, but we've also seen Amazon workers going on strike this week because they are simply not prepared to put up with this erosion of their quality of life, their standard of living, and their disposable income.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, this, you know, basically, the reason why class struggle is such an important concept is because working class got to fight. They don't have a choice, really. You've got to fight to try and preserve your wages. You won't necessarily succeed, but you've still got to try. Because if you don't, then you're just going to gradually be squeezed, you know, to pieces.
Anyway, one of the most shocking...
You know, but there's going to, you know, this is a return to the old days when people realised that we're trade-offs, you know, and if some people are going to make loads of profits, other people have got to make sure that their wages keep up with that. Otherwise, that, you know, and, you know, we've been on the back foot for many years. Hopefully this is a turning point and things are going to start moving in the right direction.
Well, it's only amongst people who are organised. That's the thing, because otherwise people just get they get isolated.
See, if you've got a well-organised
trade, if you've got an atomised workforce, then without unions, then I'm afraid it's very difficult to do anything.
Well, you can control inflation. With using trade unions in Scandinavia, they were able for many decades, and they still do it to a large extent, to control wage inflation through agreement. Rather than just by sacking people.
Well, anyway, one of the main things, of course, that needs to be happening right now is the left needs to get its act together in opposition and in solidarity with the unions in order to make sure that we don't get this enormous erosion of living standards amongst the even the organised workforce, like the rail workers, the nurses and people like this, the teachers. This week, I think it may actually have been a little while ago, I think it may have been this week actually, or the last weekend, or last week, Keir Starmer was confronted by up in Liverpool by a Labour member called Audrey White. And we have a listen to what she had to say to him, because we also heard this week that she's just got a letter from the Labour Party saying she's no longer a member because she's not allowed to confront the leader in this way.
Can I just say that I don't know how you've got the guts to come to this city after you have been being interviewed and doing columns for the Sun newspaper, after the way we as a city were abused, and after the way we as a city, the Hillsborough victims, were abused by our paper, and you've come here. Secondly, you lied to us about uniting the party. I'm still a Labour Party member, and you've expelled and witch-hunted in the most vicious way I've ever seen in my lifetime. And I've been a member of the Labour Party for a long, long time. You have absolutely said you had 10 pledges, you were going to carry on the Corbyn legacy. And ever since, you've done nothing but distance yourself from the ideas which tens of thousands of people joined the Labour Party to support, and you, all you've done is feed into the Tory ideology of not supporting strikes, of carrying on with the privatisation of our health service. You're doing everything to feed into a Tory victory, because we may as well have a Tory if we have a person like you who lies to the party. It's dishonesty.
Thank you very much.
And our health service is going right down the pan, and you have a big responsibility to the working class people of this country.
Can you move back, please?
Excuse me. You're just, don't be getting physical.
No, I'm not touching you. Can you move back then, please?
You're touching my breast.
Can you move back, please?
Now move back.
Well, there's an assertive lady. That's Audrey White there. If you've seen the clip, Keir Starmer, this is the video. Keir Starmer, there's something of the Tommy Cooper about his eyes. I mean, he just looks like he's kind of dusty. Hasn't got a clue what to say. And, of course, you don't hear him reply to anything she's saying there or try to really dispute with her, only get some of his apparatchiks to send her a letter, Martin, saying you're out the party.
Yeah, well, obviously, I don't really know what grounds they've given to push her out of the party. Obviously, you know, she'd set that up and ambushed him when he came to Liverpool, and he didn't want to answer her because he doesn't want to actually talk about any of the things she's not happy about. But I think he's only got himself to blame here, because he's gone out of his way to pick a fight with the left of the party so that he can then appeal to what he thinks of as middle of the road voters and, you know, the business community and all the rest of it. So it's been part of his strategy to have howls of outrage from the left as part of him not being, you know, he can say, well, I don't take any notice of those kind of people. But of course, in order to win the election, what he promised was that he would basically try to unite both wings of the party. It's clear that that's not happening now at all. Yeah,
and in any way, she's absolutely right, isn't she? He did lie. His 10 pledges, none of them have been kept. But anyhow, this is part of the problem, is the only real opposition seems to be within the leadership of the main public sector trade unions and within the Tory party. It's incredible that someone can be so ineffective as a leader. Anyway, I spoke this week to Tony Greenstein, who's the first Jew to get expelled from the Labour Party for anti-Semitism, supposed anti-Semitism, which, of course, he still disputes. And here he talks about the expulsion of Audrey, but also about his new book, Zionism During the Holocaust, which is just coming out any time now, as well as one of the things that initially got me thinking, well, let's get Tony on again, is because PayPal have suspended his account and booted him off their platform. Now, PayPal is, quite an important place that people can buy things from you, buy your books, etc., and give donations. So here's Tony Greenstein now, an extended interview with him, but particularly focusing in the middle part of the interview on his new book, Zionism During the Holocaust.
I'm Tony Greenstein. I was the first Jewish member to be expelled the Labour Party, co-founded Palestine Solidarity Campaign, long-standing Jewish. I don't know what else. My dad was a rabbi. Of course, he's no longer with us. I've been active as an anti-Zionist for about 50 years or more.
Okay, so what exactly were you expelled from the Labour Party for?
Well, I was expelled as part of the anti-Semitism witch hunt, but they never accused me of anti-Semitism, apart from using Zio, which is short for Zionist, which isn't anti-Semitic. But it was a whole number of things connected with Israel. The first queries were the fact that I compared Israel's marriage laws to those in Nazi Germany, until I pointed out that Hannah Arendt had also said that, and was she anti-Semitic? And quoting an article which said that Israel was waiting for the Holocaust survivors to die, so it didn't have to pay them benefits. So again, I pointed out it was a Haaretz article. So it started off with really about Israel, although they always denied that anti-Semitism had anything to do with Israel. You know, I mean, that was their kind of double standards. But then it went on to abuse of Zionists. I get a lot of abuse for Zionists, and I give as good as I get. So if you retaliate, then you're guilty. But I mean, we all know from the Ford report what it was about. You know, I mean, the evidence is quite clear. They were looking for any and every pretext, and I was singled out by the Jewish Labour movement for targeting. You know, I was the first, but I wasn't the last. I mean, today, if you're Jewish, you're five times more likely to be expelled from the Labour Party if you're not Jewish. But that is what the fight about against anti-Semitism is about. So we all know that Keir Starmer is a complete hypocrite in every sense, shape and form.
Well, he certainly seems to be. I noticed someone was expelled today, Tony, for confronting Keir Starmer in the street. And the notice that they were sent, the letter they were sent expelling them, said that they had given an interview. So Labour Party members apparently are not allowed to give interviews. Can you just explain why it is that by having a difference of opinion in public with Keir Starmer is now a sackable offence if you're a Labour member?
Well, I don't know whether you're referring to the Audrey White interview. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah.
Well, if you saw it, it made for brilliant film. Really, she berated him and asked him how the hell he had the nerve to come to Liverpool after writing in the Sun, given what had happened at Hillsborough and how he'd divided the Labour Party, how he'd lied to become a leader. And he just sat there like a frozen rabbit. he doesn't have anything whatsoever to say, you know. This is him. I mean, he's a man with completely without personality, without any excuse whatsoever. So it's really punishment for showing him up in public, isn't it? I mean, nothing more. It's just petty revenge from a man who's really got nothing in the way of charisma or presence, or really, he's a machine politician. What could you say?
Well, it's quite important that there are people like yourself around, Tony, who are pushing these lines into the left, basically explaining these things, particularly as a Jew yourself. And I noticed that you have yourself been subject to, I mean, we all need a little bit of cash, not necessarily the billions that the London media spend every few months on peddling nonsense, largely from the places like ITV, BBC, the rest of them. It's becoming very, very propagandistic. But at least, thank God, we've still got the bloggers. We've still got a bit of internet freedom. And we do need a little bit of money to keep going. And I noticed that you had a bit of problem along those lines recently. Even that is proving too much for some of these big tech giants.
Well, that's right. I mean, I presume you're referring to PayPal, which after 15 years, suddenly he sent me an email saying you breached our acceptable use policy, whatever that means, you know, absolutely absurd. I asked them for details, you know, I mean, because they've got reams of policy, but I mean, which one would apply to you? Who knows?
And what have you been money laundering?
It had £1,000 in it, you know. I mean, it had the odd donation which came in every other week. I mean, tens or £20 usually. I mean, no, I mean, it had just over £1,000 in it, which I transferred out. But, you know, I mean, they try to prevent us organising through closing down our banking facilities. I mean, this is what the Palestinians have experienced, of course, because PayPal refuses to allow Palestinians in the West Bank to use PayPal. But the Jewish settlers, who shouldn't even be there legally, they're entitled to use it. So it's just a horrible US corporation, just another arm of the US state, really. I mean, when it comes down to it, they all toe the line, or in the case of YouTube, it puts on reminders that RT is a Russian station. It, of course, doesn't say that BBC is funded by the Home Office of the British taxpayer, or rather the British government, really. So, I mean, you know, when these double standards apply, we live in a capitalist society, and we have to expect this. But I'll survive. People will divert their money to a bank account. So let's hope the bank doesn't get rid of us as well. You know, I mean, it's one after the other, really.
Well, you're painting a picture here of a kind of coordinated political campaign which runs right across all the way from Keir Starmer and the Labour Party, right the way through to these big, massive US mega corporations. Now, that is to say, a pro-Zionist campaign along those lines. Now, you know, you could be labelled a conspiracy theorist for that. You could even be labelled an anti-Semite, Tony.
Well, firstly, conspiracy theorists aren't necessarily anti-Semites. Secondly, I don't think it's a conspiracy in the sense that one or two people at the top, if you like, pull all the strings. I think there's a consensus, a kind of foreign policy consensus. The US establishment, the British establishment and so on, long ago adopted Zionism as its policy in the Middle East. In other words, you know, sending the Jews to Israel and creating a very, very reactionary state, which is what they've done. A state which guards over the Arab countries and attacks any regime that steps out of line and so on. So it's a kind of accepted consensus. I mean, it was like Andrew Marr. He said to Noam Chomsky, do you think that someone tells me what to say? And Chomsky said, no, but if you didn't hold the opinions you had, then you wouldn't be where you are now. And that's really what it is. Anyone who's radical, like John Pilger, doesn't get a look in on mainstream TV, does he? Because, you know, there's a consensus against having him there. And the same with all of them. I mean, the Guardian's now, of course, become a tame puppet for the state. I mean, it's adopted the denotices. It went on the denotice committee. And I can remember when the Guardian proudly said, we're not cooperating with the denotice system. So, I mean, you have that change, and the kind of liberals have gone to the right. And you see that over Assange. I mean, the Liberals say nothing, absolutely nothing. It's often Tory mavericks, Andrew Neil, Peter Robourn, Peter Hitchens. They're the ones who've spoken out. I mean, you know, BBC journalists, are they over them? No. Guardian? Half of them supported deportation. So it's not a conspiracy. I don't believe that, you know, one or two people in the US government are coordinating this, or in Tel Aviv. I just think it's the consensus amongst these people. It's a pro-imperialist consensus, and that means people like me are targeted. And of course, Israel is the outrider for them. So its lobbies are particularly active in trying to take down anyone who's a perceived enemy. I mean, that's my explanation.
Well, we have a very strong actual Christian Zionist lobby in the United States. But I wonder, to what extent are these people really sort of church-going believers who follow Christ? Or is this a sort of, it almost seems to be like a kind of clique mentality, a herd mentality, where they think this is what they should think, and so they think it. Where do you think? Is it somewhere between?
Well, Christian Zionism is really is an interesting phenomenon. You know, I mean, you can take what you want from the Bible, and, you know, most Christians today would take, you know, love of a fellow man, peace, justice, etc. But the ruling classes have always interpreted the New Testament, just like the Old Testament and the Quran, etc., as an instrument to justify their oppression. I mean, you know, I mean, in the 15th, 16th century, possession of a Bible was a capital offence under Henry VIII, because the common masses would not understand some of the things about blessed be the meek, or shall inherit the earth, and all that. So it's the same. The Christian Zionists are Christian imperialists, to put to the sword anyone who opposes the United States. They accept you know, the manifest destiny of the US imperial hegemon. And Protestantism, because it was a bourgeois religion, it adopted a kind of religious nationalism everywhere. And it's interesting, in Germany, of course, a large part of the Protestant church in particular supported Hitler for the same reason, and disavowed the Old Testament. But Catholic Church actually less so, because of its international connections and so on. But it's very interesting. But no, I mean, Christian Zionism, I mean, you know, it's really anything but Christian when it comes to it. I mean, as far as they're concerned, God promised the Jews Israel. You know, this isn't a God of justice or peace. This is a God of war. I mean, that's their interpretation. And you can interpret any religion in any way you want. Yeah, you can pick and choose.
Yeah, one of the things I find so fascinating is that we had Christians, Jews and Muslims living in Palestine very much in harmony and peace together. Before, we had this Zionist terror groups and the state created in the 1940s.
Oh, yes. I mean, Chaim Weizmann, who was the first president of Israel and the long-standing president of the Zionist organization, spoke in his book, his autobiography, Trial and Error, about the old Yeshuv. The Yeshuv is the word for the Jewish community in Palestine. And they were anti-Zionists. They were hostile to Zionism. They didn't want these European settlers coming and disturbing their relationships, which were very good. I mean, by the middle of the 19th century, Jews were in a majority in Jerusalem. But it was quite a natural development. And, you know, Orthodox Jews would emigrate and so on. But it didn't have any political implications. Indeed, the Orthodox Jews threw up their hands in horror at the idea of Jewish statehood. They saw it as a kind of idolatry, a worship of the state, like the worship of the golden calf. But Zionism, of course, has been insidious, and it's taken over the vast majority of the Orthodox Jews, except for things like groups like the Netorei Tata. So religion adapts to circumstances. It's like a chameleon in many ways. It's, you know, I mean, in Israel, who do they look to? Joshua, in the book of Joshua, who slaughtered all before him. They don't quote the many passages about welcoming the stranger. So, I mean, that is the nature of religion, I'm afraid.
Well, it is, yeah. And a religio, of course, in the ancient classical text, the actual word means in the Greek to bind. So the idea, I suppose, is to take an idea and then tie people up in knots. That's what it seems to me sometimes. Tony, you know, what about the origins of Zionism? This is something I know you've looked into, because well, as I understand it, it's basically a British thing.
I'm not sure whether you can just call it British. I mean, it was a Christian Zionist. I mean, certainly in Britain was the major imperial power. It was the Christian Zionists who were the first Zionists, not the Jews. The Jews reacted with horror when Zionism first came upon them. They saw it as a species of anti-Semitism, nothing more. Because, I mean, you know, all the people who welcomed the Zionists were the anti-Semites. They thought, great, this will get rid of the Jews for us. And so Zionism was seen as a form of Jewish anti-Semitism. And the first Zionists were, I mean, not just British. I mean, it was Napoleon the First and the Third. There was Ernest Laharan, who was Napoleon the Third's secretary. Then there was Palmerston, the Earl Shaftesbury, Disraeli, George Eliot in her, if you remember the novel, Daniel Deronda. And you could say it goes back right to Cromwell, really. I mean, there's been a steady tradition of Christian Zionism. Why? Because having Jews establish a settlement in Palestine was an absolutely great way of legitimizing British imperialism. And in fact, all the European powers did it. They all wanted to sponsor Zionism in a sense. It was actually a rush and a competition at the time of the First World War to see who could do it. But I mean, the British got in there first. I mean, that's all really. I mean, it was a French equivalent of the Balfour Declaration, but we don't hear too much of it. So, yeah, I mean, Zionism was always an imperialist project.
Yeah, and certainly the Americans very much involved. What do you make of Nancy Pelosi and her visit to Taiwan this week?
Well, what can I say? What can I say? She's really concerned about the threat to Taiwan, although China in practice isn't threatening Taiwan, but it refuses to accept that Taiwan is anything but part of China as a whole, and that's correct, and it is. She didn't make a trip to Kurdistan, did she? I mean, she didn't make a trip to the Basque country or Catalonia or all the many other places which are suffering from national oppression. She didn't make a trip to Yemen. You know, I mean, the utter hypocrisy. I mean, they masquerade their warlike intentions under a cloak of humanitarianism, nothing more. So, yeah, it's abysmal. She's stoking war. And we know what the Ukraine war is about. It's really just, it's the hors d'oeuvre for a conflict with China. Why? Because China is a growing power which challenges U.S. economic and therefore military supremacy. So, I mean, yes, we're in very dangerous times at the moment because, I mean, you could see a nuclear war. I mean, if Russia had its back to the wall, it's possible they could use nuclear weapons, and then we may all say goodbye.
Well, dangerous, particularly for the Labour Party with Keir Starmer in charge, but a bit less dangerous if Liz Truss takes over. What do you make of the Tory leadership race?
Oh, well, it's abysmal. It's a contest between two dinosaurs, isn't it? I don't accept that Liz Truss is less dangerous than Starmer. I mean, she's, if you like, on the hawkish wing of the Tory party. I mean, you know, I mean, she wants to go all guns blazing. I mean, it's pathetic, really, because, I mean, Britain is not an independent power. It kind of yaps at the side of the American dog. Really, it doesn't carry any independent power. And you saw that when Gavin Williamson threatened the Chinese. So, I mean, these people want to be dictators, but they don't have the power because Britain is a busted flush, really, in the world militarily. I mean, you know, and this idea we're going to spend another, increase the military budget by 50% at the time when people can't heat or feed themselves. I mean, it's just lousy politics. But Starmer is just particularly despicable because instead of like leading a fight back, instead of keeping to the promises that he was elected leader as, that he was continuing the Corbyn tradition, he's tearing all of that up. I mean, the man's an utter disgrace. But what can you say?
Well, you can say hooray if you're a Tory.
Well, yes, because he'll lose the next election almost certainly, because why vote for the carbon copy Tory when you can vote for the real thing?
Who do you think will win then?
Well, I think the Tories will win. Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean,
in the leadership race between
Truss and it looks odds on Truss, doesn't it? I mean, from what I can see, they're going for the most hawkish of all. I mean, Sunak's pretty much on the right. I mean, there's nothing progressive about the guy at all. You know, I don't have a dog in the race, if that's what you're asking.
No, I'm not. But, I mean, you know, it seems that, you know, somehow Starmer has successfully managed to completely sideline the Labour Party in British politics, and everyone has just been focusing on the Tories and even the opposition within the Tory party rather than on the other benches.
I know. I mean, the reason is, of course, Starmer has nothing to say. If you're going to mimic the government, then you don't distinguish yourself. And that's why he just comes out with these trite phrases about dignity, respect, unity, and so on. Because he's got nothing to say. He just wraps himself in the flag, a kind of cheap populist. But that doesn't really wash, because, you know, at the end of the day, cheap nationalism doesn't feed the family.
No.
And that's what it's about.
I mean, personally, listening to, you know, for voices, as you say, Starmer's got nothing to say. Mick Lynch seems to be a potential leader, actually, of the left.
He's been very credible. I mean, I don't know how much he would be a leader of it, because I think they're being incredibly moderate, the RMT. They're not going on an all-out strike. Their demands, you know, I mean, they're demanding 7%, which is below inflation, but he comes across very well. I mean, he's got a kind of sense of humour, and he can explain things simply, and Starmer can't do that. He can't articulate any message whatsoever. And that, you know, he's just pathetic. He has all the worst aspects of a QC, who can quote some clauses of the law, but really has no overall vision. I mean, the tragedy is that Jeremy Corbyn ever put him in that position and put him in the shadow cabinet. And that was, again, a problem of appeasement to the right. Yeah. I just hope that people learn their lesson.
Can you just tell people tell our listeners about this book you were mentioning and how to follow your stuff online generally?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can get to my blog on www.azvsas.blogspot.com. Just Google Tony Greenstein. You'll find it. Or tonygreenstein.com. Sorry, what was the other question you asked?
Book.
Oh, yes, my book. Yes, I'm bringing it out any moment now. I should get the first copy so I can look through the mistakes and anything else by the weekend. It's on Zionism during the Holocaust, so it's divided into three sections: before, during, and after. And it shows that during the Holocaust, the Zionists fought against doing anything about the Holocaust. They actually opposed Jewish refugees going to countries that can save them, because they had this weird logic that, well, if other countries could save Jews, then what was the point of a Jewish state? They actually opposed, you know, the scheme to send you to Alaska, to Darwin, Australia, Santo Domingo. They opposed them all. They campaigned against any refugee scheme. And, of course, they had cordial relationships with the Nazis until 1939, and they were the Quisling Jewish councils, the Judenrats in Europe. And it's quite ironic, you see, Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian, who's a notorious Zionist, when it comes to write a book about a Jewish resistance hero during the Holocaust, who does he choose? Rudolf Werber, who escaped from Auschwitz, who was an anti-Zionist, who refused to live in Israel, and whose Auschwitz protocols, which were issued before the Hungarian Holocaust to warn Hungarian Jews, were handed to this guy Kastner, the leader of Hungarian Zionism, who then suppressed them. So, I mean, the role of the Zionists during the war is not a pretty one, and that is really what my book is about. And, of course, the Zionists took my crowdfunder down because they didn't want me raising funds to print it. but it failed in that too. So I don't give up easily.
Well, good to hear that. Okay, so those blogs, I imagine, where people can either get hold of the book or donate, Tony.
Yes, yeah, so it'll be on my blog. Have no fear. I shall be publicising it and doing quite a number of Zoom meetings, book launches around it as well. So people will have plenty of opportunity, and I'm buying 1,000 of them anyway myself. So I'm laying the money out in order that if the Zionists go for the publishing company, they'll do it too late.
Tony Greenstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So that's Tony Greenstein speaking to me this week about his new book. I suppose, Martin, the obvious question there is, this is cancelled history, basically, isn't it, that he's digging out here?
Yes. And, you know, there's a concentration. I mean, he said there isn't a conspiracy. In a sense, he's right. It's a consensus. But you can be sure that, you know, Israeli Defense Force Psychological Warfare Office, what they call Hasbara, they're very, very active. And they target people. They targeted us, if you remember. UK Lawyers for Israel complained to Ofcom about this very show. And you'd have thought, well, you know, were we that important? But they're very, very active. And it's because they haven't really got a leg to stand on, which is why they have to run so hard.
Yeah, so is a few, some quite controversial things he's saying there about the Zionist cooperation with the Nazis. He's saying that basically it ended in 1939 when the Second World War began, Martin. It's pretty, and it's certainly that's new to me. I thought it was earlier in the Nazi regime.
Well, I haven't read the book, so, and he's obviously done the research for the book, and, you know, I trust him to do the research properly. But, of course, Ken Livingstone was kicked out of the Labour Party for pointing out the obvious point that there was cooperation between the Zionists and the Nazis, because there was. I remember reading an article in History Today from the 1960s about a scoping mission with an SS colonel and a Zionist official going to Palestine to look into whether it would be possible for the Jews to go to Palestine. And of course, it's very embarrassing to the modern Zionist movement to have had that relationship. But it was definitely there. And of course, the Jabotinskyite right wing in Israel itself modelled itself on Mussolini's black shirts. Zionism was one of those nationalistic movements with a right wing orientation, although there was a left wing to it as well. But a lot of the right wingers were basically classic right wing nationalists. And, you know, Einstein pointed this out in the 1940s. That the kind of mentality of the Zionists in Israel was not dissimilar to that of the fascists. And, you know, they don't like hearing that, but I'm afraid it's true.
OK, we'll wind up just before the break with a look at the Hiroshima anniversary. They call Hiroshima Day. Bristol's Hiroshima-Nagasaki Peace Gathering returns to Castle Park this weekend to mark the anniversary of dropping the atomic bombs on Japan in World War II. The four-day event, organised by XR Peace and Bristol CND, includes a packed schedule of talks, workshops, music and craftivism. A full timetable events is available on the Bristol CND website. I'll put a link up to that on our show page. Saturday, tomorrow, a die-in at 8:15 a.m, which is the moment the first atomic bomb struck Hiroshima. And an incident ended the lives of tens of thousands of civilians. Well, I'm not sure they all died absolutely instantly. I think quite a few took a while to die. That's the nature of these particularly horrific weapons, and would later die of injuries, burns and radiation sickness. On Sunday, the vigils joined by Christian Climate Action, Reverend Sue Parfit will deliver a communion service. Christian Climate Action, I wonder what that is anyway. This is followed by talks on conflict, climate change and decolonisation. Well, interesting, isn't it, that this whole thing about Hiroshima is now being done as a climate thing too. I think we'd be a little bit careful, actually, about trying to conflate these various issues. I don't think climate has really got anything to do with, unless it's simply that the climate people, many of them think that nuclear power is good, and so they see it's a useful place to turn up in order to try and convince the anti-nuclear weapons people that nuclear power is a good thing to have, Martin.
Well, I don't know what the organisers of planned there, but it sounds like there's quite a lot going on. And clearly we do need to remember what happened at Hiroshima, especially as the situation in the global situation is probably closer to nuclear war than we've been since 1962.
But I mean, as we've been discussing many, many years here, and particularly last week with Roy Pumphrey from Stop Hinkley, the nuclear weapons program is absolutely dependent on the nuclear power program. And also it's a sort of apprenticeship for people that go into nuclear weapons. All of them pretty much do their apprenticeship in the nuclear power world, and then they go through a rotating door into the weapons world. And many of the climate activists are now saying that nuclear power is the future. So anyway, I think quite an interesting fact that the climate people are now getting involved in this day and promoting it as a climate thing, something to do with Hiroshima Day, which is bizarre to me. I certainly wouldn't be taking part in anything to do with climate if you were doing something on Hiroshima. It's very important, but climate not, and particularly nuclear stuff to do with climate, needs to be very carefully looked at. But okay, so we're going to have a listen now to Before the Break, and we'll be running straight on from this little quote you're about to hear to our musical break. Harry S. Truman, back on the 6th of August 1945, announcing the first atomic bomb. And if you listen here, you will hear he talks about Hiroshima as being a military base, which, of course, it wasn't.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
And now the break.
Psalm 91, Assurance of God's Protection. You who live in the shelter of the Most High, who abide in the shadow of the Almighty, will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and buckler. You will not fear the terror of the night, or the arrow that flies by day, or the pestilence that stalks in the darkness, or the destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. You will only look with your eyes and see the punishment of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord your refuge, the Most High your dwelling place, no evil shall befall you. No scourge come near your tent, for he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they shall bear you up, so that you will not dash your foot against a stone. You will tread on the lion and the adder, the young lion and the serpent you will trample underfoot. Those who love me I will deliver. I will protect those who know my name. When they call to me, I will answer them. I will be with them in trouble. I will rescue them and honor them. With long life, I will satisfy them and show them my salvation. This is the word of the Lord.
took a trip down to look at the fair. When I arrived, I found nobody there. It seemed I was all alone. Must be that they've all gone home. A trip to the fair, but nobody was there. A trip to the fair, but nobody was there. Voices of yesterday make not a sound. Even the roundabout stop going round. I wonder just what it means. Is everything how it seems? A trip to the fair, but nobody was there. A trip to the fair. The dudgeons came onto the scene. Wheels began turning, I started to scream. A carousel swung around. My head spun and hit the ground. A trip to the fair, but nobody was there. To hide. Stars of tomorrow to look at the fair. When I arrived, I found nobody there. It seemed I was all alone. Must be that they've all gone home. A trip to the
Okay, so that's Renaissance there, A Trip to the Fair, the year 1975. Before that, we heard the NRSV, I guess that's the New Revised Standard Version of Psalm 91. For Holocaust Day, Hiroshima Day, whatever you want to call it, it's about the nuclear weapons. It's not about the climate, although some people seem to think it is. Anyway, just to before we get off the subject of climate and plunge into Ukraine and part two, I thought it'd be quite interesting to have a listen to something that's been going on over in Holland, which is the enormous demonstrations by Dutch farmers. And this is all over the carbon agenda, the zero carbon agenda, whatever is driving this. We've got this tiny little company, it seems, that's what's been being talked about in the press recently, is this tiny company in Cornwall, which is in charge of the spending of £70 billion of British taxpayers' money on the zero carbon agenda. Well, of course, some of that money is coming from the energy companies itself, but this organization called the Place Group will control, manage and deliver the public sector transition to net zero. Now, this is something which apparently has been decided by government without really necessarily thinking about the consequences and what they will be. We've already seen these extra green taxes, the RTFO, the Renewable Transport Fuel Obligation, monies going on to diesel and petrol, 20 pence each over Christmas. This has caused, well, if you look at the prices, this is roughly a 10%, 11% increase in the price. Of course, it's massively fueling inflation. This is something which, if you go back to last year, there was a dispute at the cabinet between Rishi Sunak, who wanted to bring these in, these extra green taxes in on fuel, particularly. I mean, I don't know about gas, but this is certainly on renewable transport. So that's diesel and petrol. And Boris basically said, no, you can't do that because it's going to cause massive inflation. Well, of course, they did it anyway, behind Boris's back, in collusion, the Treasury in collusion with the oil companies. So whilst the oil companies had hiked their prices back in September, October, when it came to Christmas, they put the prices down 20 pence a litre overnight on the 31st of December, just as this RTFO came in. And so that's a way of concealing it. So it shows you who's really running the country. It's the Treasury and the city in collusion with BP, Shell and Exxon. They are running the country. They are making policy decisions. Anyway, this little company based in Cornwall has been given the job of helping to deliver this £70 billion framework to aid the country's transition to net zero, the target of completely negating the amount of greenhouse gases by reducing emissions. The Place Group, which is based at the Regent Chapel Street, Penzance, won a huge framework tender to control, manage and deliver the public sector transition to net zero. It will act as a middleman overseeing the framework for services, products, solutions and support for everything net zero via the contracting authority East of England Broadband Network. The small company is a specialist consulting project management research company with 18 years experience in the field of, climate or anything like that, but just education generally. So fascinating aspect to the way this is being implemented, you just heard there, and also the interesting little teeny company that's doing it. So anyway, we will hear now from the Dutch farmers. This guy, particular guy, his name is Jeroen Vermeener. I think Vermeener, he will pronounce it himself. The Dutch dairy farmer will talk to you and explain what's been going on in Holland and why the farmers are so upset about this zero carbon strategy, particularly, well, it's not about carbon over in Holland, apparently. It's mainly about nitrogen. But why the Dutch farmers are basically being driven out of business by this amazing zero carbon strategy.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jeroen Vermeener. I'm a dairy farmer from Zeewolde, a city in the middle of the Netherlands. Someone asked me if I could send a message, what's going on in Holland, what's all about these farmer protests and why are Dutch farmers angry. Well, the farmer protests are already here since 2.5 years. The 1st of October 2019 was the first time Dutch farmers had a very big protest. We all went to The Hague. And actually, there was more like some protest about the wind, which was blowing already probably for 30 years, that somewhere there's a problem in the environment. There's a problem with pollution. Agriculture sector gets pointed at as main cause of all problems. After that, after the biggest protest, nitrogen problems came up, and nitrogen problems aren't new. 30 years ago already, nature people start talking about nitrogen pollution, which would make the rain sour, and all the sour rain would cause lots of damage to the nature parks, to forests. And when you would hear these voices, all the nature would be gone in a few years. Well, 30 years later, nature's still there. Most of it is in excellent condition. Well, 2.5 years, people start talking about nitrogen emission, ammonia from agriculture sector. There's also nitrogen pollution because of the traffic, because of the industry, nitrogen oxides. But we don't talk about it a lot. When a nitrogen problem is called in Holland, it's focusing most of the times on the agriculture sector only. Well, when the thing started, and actually what I wanted to do is reducing the nitrogen emission, and especially the nitrogen deposition on nature parks. Well, it started, agriculture sector came together, all parties like the dairy industry, pork industry, chicken industry, you could ever call whatever industries, came together, made a big plan. There was a lot of solutions in it, and we tried to solve the problem. Our government, in the meanwhile, went on with making other plans, which resulted in the latest new plan a few weeks ago, and it's terrible. It's idiot, and it's of no use. What they did is they divided Holland in different regions. Some regions have to lower their emissions by 12%. Some regions have to lower their emissions by 46%, 75% or 95%. In the meanwhile, our juridical system is this on this moment that no innovations in agriculture sector are allowed to use. So there are different techniques for lowering your emission, but when you are asked for a court and a judge will look into your innovations, they will say you can't use it. So the only reason, the only thing to lower your emissions right now is just cutting your herd back. And actually, you're probably coming at the main cause of it all. Nitrogen is more like, we call it stick to beat the dog. It's just to camouflage the real cause. some left-wing parties in Holland and probably all over the world, it's the same movement. They want to get rid of animal industries. They want to have a transition to more plant-based food, transition to vegetarians. We have all the stuff together. In Holland, we also have a party like that, and they asked for 50% reduction of our national herd. That's probably, on this moment, the main cause of it all. We're not talking about nitrogen. No, they just want to reduce the national herd. Well, every farmer all around the world and also every citizen knows that cutting back the herd isn't the cause of any problems. You know, we are producing food. Two-thirds of agricultural land on the planet can only be grown by grass. And you need cows like this for making grass into meat or into milk or whatever you want. Whatever problem with emissions, with pollution on the world you are asking about, whether it's not chemical, but farming is probably a part of the problem, but most of it all, it's part of the solution. Well, Dutch farmers now are getting angry every day more. Government is not listening. And what we are fearing for is we have to leave our land. And that's also a deeper agenda behind it. In Holland, they just want to have farmers' land. 62% of the area in Holland is farmed by farmers. And what they want to do is they want to have the land cheap, so they're making it nature first. And when they have the land in their hands, they can build houses on it. Houses we don't need by Dutch citizens, because average Dutch couple is getting 1.8, 1.9 kids. So what's the problem of the demand for houses, that we get 100,000 refugees in this country every year? That's why they have to build houses. Well, that's a shortcut of our problems right now. Farmers are getting angry. They're not listened by the government. Every solution we came on with, they don't take it. And what we see right now, when we have to reduce our national herd, when we have to reduce our herds by ourselves, farms will break down. On this moment, when the plan of the government is coming through, probably 30, 40, 50% of the farmers have to fear for the future. That's why we're on the streets. That's why we're protesting. That's why the protesters are going harder. And actually, quite happily, all around the world, people start looking at Holland, what's happening there. Well, what the warning from the Dutch farmers is that every citizen from Holland especially, but also in Europe, probably around the globe, have to look at what do we want to have to eat in a few years' time. Dutch agriculture is champion, world champion on every class, whether we talk about nitrogen, whether we talk about other pollutions. Dutch farming is best in all chapters. So it's no solution to get rid of Dutch farmers. The production, which is going away up here, needs to come back in another different area from the world. Well, we need transport for that. It gives CO2 emissions. And also the standards of production up there aren't as high as in Dutch agriculture. So that's why we're fighting on the street. We want to stay on our land. When we are part of a problem, we want to solve it. We can do it. We always did it. Nitrogen pollution, nitrogen emissions turned back 68% by agriculture sector in Holland in the last 30 years. So we prove we can do a lot of things. But we will keep on farming. We will fight for our farms. That's why we have the actions. We have the protest in the country. We're asking a lot of attention for our problems. This is in Holland we call it a farmer's handkerchief, and it's made the symbol of the battle of the farmers right now. And actually, it feels good that foreign people asking for what's happening in Holland, and we're warning you all over Europe, this problem, which is here in Holland, can be your problem in the next years. So we're asking for support from farmers and also citizens in Europe, all around the world. This problem could be your problem when citizens want to have food on the plate in the next 10 years. Then we have to stand up for our farmers. Dutch farmers are standing up. We are supporting all farmers around the world. Keep on doing what we do, and we have to start fighting for our farms, for our future, for our families, and for food on the table. Thanks very much.
Well, fascinating, I think, to actually hear from Dutch farmers themselves. This is the sort of talk which is going around in amongst British farmers too, as people like George Monbiot seem to get their teeth into the policymakers via the Treasury in order to do similar things to, horse grazers, this is one of the most horrific things I've seen recently. This is up in Cumbria, where a family that's been grazing wild ponies up there that were originally used in the lead mines, but they are a fantastic breed of pony, incredibly hardy, even in the winter in the Cumbrian fells. They've basically been destroyed by English nature, who have completely destroyed this guy legally and obviously emotionally too, by telling him he can't do these things. He's, I suppose, someone they would suggest is an easy person to take out because he's not in the farmers union, I imagine. But anyway, Martin, they seem to be coming for the farmers. The sinister angle of this is we could be, I mean, the positive side, you might say, is that we'll be eating more vegetables and less meat, and this is less slaughterhouses, which nobody likes. But it could actually end up precipitating a food shortage.
Well, I mean, the issues facing farmers, some are the same around the world and some of them are different depending on what they're farming and how they're farming. I'm not an expert on what goes on in Holland, but let's just clear up some things straight away. This isn't about carbon footprints. It's about nitrogen, which gets into the water supply and is carcinogen. Yeah. And of course, the same thing is happening in Britain. George Monbiot may have gone off on a tangent, but he's done some quite good work with Charlotte Church. I'm in Herefordshire here. And there's been a massive increase in battery chicken farming in this region. And it's actually completely polluted the water supply. And this is a big issue. And, Tracy Worcester's Farms Not Factories campaign is basically about having traditional farming. But of course, a lot of farming nowadays is actually factory farming, and it's very, very destructive.
OK, well, you haven't really touched on anything that Dutch farmer said. What he's saying is it's a bit like the whole coal strike thing in the 1970s and 80s, back then it was the miners, now it's the farmers. Producing food in a very efficient way. They've got actually excellent welfare for the animals. What's happening is they are being driven out of the market in exchange for cheap imported meat, which is farmed in a horrific fashion, much of it.
Yes, well, I mean, the common agricultural policy, in fact, protects farmers in Europe. And if you didn't have something like that, then we would be getting all of our stuff from foreign farmers. I mean, the Australian and New Zealand and Argentinian farmers and Canadian farmers basically outcompeted British and European farmers in the 19th century.
I don't know if you were listening to the structure of subsidies. Martin, if you were listening to that farmer, he was saying that they are importing stuff in Europe. They're not being protected, these farmers.
That's globalization taking
place. They're being smashed, not protected.
It's globalization taking place. I'd like to know more about what farmers do in Holland, because I was reading a very interesting report about what's gone on in Saxony and Germany, where they've massively increased pig production. And we're not talking about a few pigs rooting around in the woods. We're talking about great big pig farms with thousands and thousands of pigs. And you can imagine the amount of slurry they produce is enormous.
But do you want to address the initial point, which is about, is this an attempt to destroy the food supply?
Well, what's happening all over the world is an attack upon traditional farming. And that's what the whole dispute in India was about. Millions and millions of people participated in that. And of course, what they're really worried about is they used to have guaranteed prices from the government for all the staples that they produce. And then the government would then sell them on. And they want to bring the multinationals and the globalists want to get rid of that semi-socialized system. Farming in most countries has to be heavily regulated. If you're going to, the common agricultural policy is a heavily regulated policy. If you had a free market policy, there wouldn't be much farming at all. Now, in other words,
you've got to negotiate, if you are a farmer, with the rest of society about what the rest of society wants you to do and what you think is fair for you to do. But there isn't just the right to do anything you want. I mean, if we had a free market, I mean, lots of that you saw in these Brexit voting constituencies like North Shropshire, not far from here, the farming community voted against the government because they can see that what Brexit will do is open up the market in Britain to international competition in exactly the way the Dutch farmer was talking about. And it just means that British farmers will be forced out of business. Now, ultimately, I don't agree with that, but that means you've got to intervene in the market, and that means that the government's got to have a policy. It isn't just a market solution. Let us carry on doing what we're doing.
OK, so well, before we leave the subject of zero carbon, zero nitrogen, whatever it happens to be next world, destroying one industry after another, what about this donation of $1.2 million that Prince Charles is a notorious Prince Charles? I mean, actually, they've got a photograph on the Yahoo website I'm looking at now of him wearing these dark glasses, looking like quite like a kind of mafia figure. Prince Charles rocked by reports of $1.2 million charity donation from the Bin Laden family. This Bin Laden family, there's the United States and the Anglo-Zionist Empire have had quite an interesting relationship with them, Martin, haven't they? So on the one hand, they're the biggest criminals on the planet, but on the other hand, they're our mates.
Well, the Bin Laden family, who were very close to the Saudi government and were very close to the Bush family and all the rest of it. And many of them flew out of the United States after 9/11 on US approved flights, even though everything else was grounded. Bin Laden himself was recruited as a terrorist, if you like, to fight in Afghanistan. There's pictures of him shaking hands with Zbigniew Brzezinski, the mastermind of Operation Cyclone, which was up to then the biggest covert operation in history. The Saudi elite is embedded in the Western elite.
In our minds, whether it's right or wrong, the Bin Laden family are associated with the September the 11th attacks, which is why it's so interesting that news has come out this week in the United States. Prince Charles is not, you know, the New Yorkers are looking at Prince Charles like he's some sort of devil after having, you know, funded the, you know, taken funding from the Bin Laden family. They're also pointing out that they have got the evidence now that Prince Charles skipped a ground zero visit just after 9/11, where various world leaders came along. He came over to New York, but he didn't go and visit ground zero. He decided to go off shooting at Balmoral. Shooting at Balmoral took precedence over this, according to a memoir of a former UK ambassador to Washington. The future king was supposed to have been joining grieving Americans in New York City a month after Al-Qaeda's attack brought down the World Trade Center in 2001. However, to Christopher Mayer, Britain's ambassador to the US from 1997 to 2003, just brought out a biography, has described how the Prince of Wales left brother Prince Andrew to conduct the visit whilst he went shooting, left Prince Andrew to conduct the visit whilst he went shooting instead. The account in the 2005 book, actually it's quite an old one, isn't it? DC Confidential, comes after the Sunday Times reported Charles accepted £1 million donation from the Bin Laden family for his charity. Clarence House said the donation was accepted by the trustees, but not by Prince Charles himself. So, of course, Prince Charles has got these people as cutouts, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's an issue about his charities. I mean, as we said the other week, the Queen is an official supporter of various charities, but she doesn't intervene in those charities and they're not her charities. A lot of the stuff Prince Charles does is things he set up. And of course, they have charitable status because they, you know, they're supposedly pursuing charitable goals. But he's a very hands-on participant in them.
Like anyone,
he's
at not, Radio,
you know, and therefore, is it really appropriate for somebody in his position to be? I mean, these are big business organisations. Yeah, they're charities.
They're not just business organisations either. The Prince's Trust, who anyone that worked at BBC Bristol will know, one of their presenters was one of the ambassadors for the children involved in the Prince's Trust, the teenagers. He went to jail as a paedophile. He was then sent to jail as a paedophile. So it doesn't seem as if Prince Charles's charities are that well governed.
Well, I mean, the point is, any allegations of that sort have just you know, they've got to be proved.
Well, it's not an allegation. It's not, Martin, it's not an allegation. This guy went to jail. I haven't got his name to hand. It wasn't an allegation at all. It was a fact.
I'm talking about the wider issue of whether Prince Charles should be such a hand-on charitable person. You know, it's all very well having an interest in various charities, but it seems to me that, you know, that a lot of what he's doing is very questionable. Unquestionably of charitable status, like, so all of this, you know, he's trying to rescue various you know, stately piles in the Highlands and all the rest of it. Is it really, you know, should he really be doing any of that?
Well, it's interesting. The answer to that is there's no problem with him doing that. He just seems to be taking donations from the world's gangster elite in order to do these things.
Yeah, but I mean, the gangster elite, the Bin Ladens, wider Bin Laden family, are absolutely embedded, as are various other Saudi royals and other hangers-on in the Western system. Many of them have properties in Britain. Many of them, you know, visit London all the time. They hobnob in the kind of circles that Prince Charles moves in. You know, you will find American U.S. generals and admirals will be hanging around with people from Saudi Arabia, military and otherwise.
Oh, well, anyway, that is the global elite. So one of the comments Prince Charles made a few years ago was, we had it on the show a few weeks ago, actually, was comparing Vladimir Putin to Adolf Hitler. I did an article about that at the time. I think it would be about 2015 for RT, which, if you've got the Tor browser or other means, actually the Telegram channels are a pretty good way of finding them. It is an RT article saying Prince Charles strikes another blow for the British Republic by saying such a stupid remark that Putin is like Adolf Hitler. This is not the sort of thing which is really goes down well from a head of state who are supposed to be impartial. But anyway, moving on to look at Ukraine, obviously this is something which is very much obsessing Prince Charles and his apolitical views, apparently, is that Ukrainian President Volodymyr is personally responsible, along with the United States, say the Russians, for the fatal shelling of a detention facility in the Donetsk People's Republic, claimed last week. According to the ministry statement, the missile strike using US-made HIMARS multiple rocket launchers on a prison near the village of Yelenova killed 50 prisoners of war, and 73 were then hospitalized with severe injuries. So this is Yelenovka. That's Yelenovka. And Martin, the allegation is, in much of the commentary on this, I mean, we could have done this last week, but it's interesting to see quite a lot more has come out about this attack this week, that many of these people were actually Nazis and neo-Nazis being held there.
Well, that's right. I mean, they've been separated from the regular Ukrainian army prisoners of war, because they've got a different, you know, they're basically different. They've got a different ideology. They're part of the Ukrainian armed forces, but they're basically a paramilitary unit with a paramilitary ideology.
So what's the logic of the Ukrainian army, or the NATO being the sort of puppet master of the Ukrainian army, actually killing so many of their own prisoners?
Well, the Ukrainians are claiming, and the West is claiming, that this is all a put-up job by the Russians, and that they've done it, and they're trying to do it to make the Ukrainians look bad, etc.
Well, look, to be fair, Putin has said that his project is denazification. Well, that's exactly what's happened here. Many of these Nazis are now dead.
Yes, and it's possible, just logically possible, that somebody on the Russian side, perhaps a disgruntled person from one of the breakaway republics' militias, are responsible for this, because they've got a lot of hatred towards these people. These people carried out a lot of atrocities.
Yeah, but the Russians are saying, Martin, the Russians are saying that they have evidence that the missile strike was using the US HIMARS multiple rocket launchers.
Right.
You know, the Russians don't have those, do they?
Well, I mean, they've certainly been using those missiles to indiscriminately strike into the Donbass. They've been killing people. I mean, one of the things happened last week, they dropped a load of butterfly mines all over the Donbass, which is the sort of thing children blow their foot off on. I mean, the Ukrainian atrocities in this war have been woefully unreported.
Well, I mean, there's the other thing that's happened this week, I mean, this should be the main news on the news at 10 tonight, but of course it won't be, is that Amnesty International have declared that Ukraine's tactics are endangering civilians.
That's
Ukraine,
right.
So, you know, NATO apparently working with the arms industry to get Ukraine more weapons. But Amnesty have been absolutely adamant today, saying that it's the Ukrainians which are causing many of these problems. So they're not blaming the Russians for scattering these mines around. The fighting tactics by establishing bases and launching attacks from residential areas. This is what the Ukrainian army are doing, according to Amnesty International, including schools and hospitals. We have documented a pattern, say Amnesty, of Ukrainian forces putting civilians at risk and violating the laws of war when operating in populated areas, says Agnes Calamard, Amnesty's Secretary General. Being in a defensive position does not exempt the Ukrainian military from respecting international humanitarian laws. Amnesty said the most residential areas where Ukrainian soldiers located themselves were kilometres away from front lines, and that there were viable alternatives that would not endanger civilians, Martin.
Well, that's right. The policy from the get-go, as decided by the Ukrainian army, the military, paramilitary right wing, and the British and American advisers and so on, is that they're going to use, especially the Russian-speaking population of the eastern oblasts, as human shields, because that creates a huge dilemma for the the Donetsk and Luhansk Republic forces and their Russian allies, which is that, you know, in order to get at the Ukrainian army, most of which is recruited in the West Ukraine and is not local, they've got the problem that they've placed all fortifications inside Russian speaking cities and towns.
This is not
so. It's the same sort of thing, right, in Syria.
Yeah, this is not hot air. The NGO Amnesty International actually sent people out on the ground to check all this. They said that they found Ukrainian forces using hospitals as de facto military bases in five locations in 22. Yeah,
they do that because then the Russians are in a double bind, aren't they? There's a military, they may have something like mortars or something in the hospital. They want to get to those mortars. But if they attack the hospital, then they've attacked a hospital.
In 22, the obvious thing here is it looks to me as if the Ukrainian soldiers that are doing this are relying 100% on the Western press just to cover it up. So the Western press is complicit in these war crimes.
That's right.
So anyway, in 22 out of 29 schools that Amnesty visited, their researchers either found soldiers using the premises or found evidence of current or prior military activity. Look, that is 22 out of 29 schools. I'm not sure what percentage. That's around about 80% of schools that they visited. They found evidence of soldiers using the premises. Now, this is not the place to put your military post in the middle of a school, is it?
No. And of course, what happened in Mariupol is every time the Russians tried to open up corridors for the civilian population to leave, if they attempted to leave, they were then shot down by the kind of people that were actually imprisoned in the prison, which has got hit by the HIMAR, if that's what's happened. And of course, what the Russians have been doing with these neo-Nazi prisoners is they've been interrogating them, because they're preparing all sorts of war crimes trials. And the war crimes trials will actually name people in the Ukrainian government as giving orders of to the effect that they should use civilians as pawns and hostages. And that is one of the reasons why they may have whacked the prison with the HIMAR. And of course, that also happened in Mariupol at one stage, where a Ukrainian missile was fired at the headquarters because the Azov people were not obeying orders from Kiev. Now, what this suggests to me is that we're reaching the point now where the Ukrainian army is close to collapse. And what will probably happen is then be infighting between different factions in the Ukraine about, you know, who's going to pick up the pieces.
Yeah, I mean, the backtrack to all of this story is the total censorship by the Western media and the complicity with the Nazi war crimes of what's going on over there.
The
incredible Russophobia, which seems to be, you know, basically based on the Napoleonic, Hitlerian hatred of Moscow, hatred of Russia. We are now in the latest phase of this. But one of the reporters that has been over there ever since the coup is a Brit called Graham Phillips. He's got quite a lot of followers on his YouTube channel, which is still just about there, folks. If you want to go and check it out, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. he has now been targeted, Graham has, by the UK government. So under these kind of Magnitsky Acts legislation, if you're interested in that, Alex Craner has given us chapter and verse on what that was all about over the years. And this guy, Bill Browder, what a utter crook and a criminal he is, who's inspired the UK and the US Magnitsky legislation, which just simply enables the dot of a pen with no court case for somebody to be basically financially destroyed because they're supposedly in cahoots with war criminals, whatever, super criminals. This is Graham Phillips, mate. This guy is not a war criminal. He's just a journalist telling people in the West things that the power elite do not want and NATO do not want people to hear. And so let's have a listen to Graham Phillips now. Here he is talking about how his bank accounts were seized. He's just finished a whole load of reports from Severodonetsk, which last month was the final large city to be liberated from Ukrainian control by the Russians. And actually what he's going around there finding is that many of the people are very happy to see the back of the Ukrainian army and the Ukrainian government. And I mean, obviously, they may be saying that just now because they're in Russian territory. They might be behaving themselves. But we need to hear this, Graham. Graham's been doing a fantastic job and he needs a big old pat on the back not to be censured and censored by the British. So let's have a listen now to Graham Phillips talking about what he's been up to and being targeted specifically by the British government to be financially destroyed.
I'm returning from a full day of doing what I love most, the reportage, as I like to call it, reporting, as others call it, from Severodonetsk in the LNR, Donbass. As I say, what I love doing most, obviously, driving the Jag as well, it's right up there. And something that, understandably, is not on my most loved list, is dealing with the fallout from the UK government's Kafka-esque decision to sanction me for doing what I've been doing from Donbass since 2014, which is for the most part I'm speaking to you here, but for the most part my reportage is putting the camera on the people of Donbass and letting them say in their own words with no censor what is going on. But it turns out that is something that the UK government are so afraid of that they have to do everything they can to eliminate it, to take me out of the game. And to do that, they're prepared. Obviously, it was the first British person sanctioned in the week. So surreal to be even saying this. Videos you never thought you'd have to make, reaction to being sanctioned by your own government. They've obviously done away with the Magna Carta. Who even heard of that? The entire judicial and justice system to sanction me. So that means that I've been punished as a criminal without any charges pressed against me, any accusations, no opportunity to defend myself, the British government, or even, it seems to be, Liz Truss's personal initiative, Vendetta, have done away with all of that, all of our much vaunted, respected, venerated judicial system, and just gone from disapproving my work, bypass the whole justice system, to punishing me like a criminal, so seizing all of my assets, bank account, everything. So effectively making me an exile from the UK without having the courage to actually do that, because how can I even return if I can't even buy a plane ticket? Because as I say, they've seized all of my bank accounts. I'm speaking like I have a lot, I just have two, one and a backup, but all frozen, all seized. Quite surreal. You feel like you're sort of with Sandra Bullock in The Net, and just dealing with the fallout of all of that, all of the media, obviously inquiries. I know that in any case, the British press are going to stick the boot in. They don't care that what's happened to me has consequences for every British person. They just want to obviously put the boot in, which is fine, and they'll do that anyway. But if I don't respond, then it will be even worse. I've been taking time to deal with that, address all of the fallout, and as I say, that's a logistical issue for a few days, but in no way, in no case, has the actions of the British government in any way served to demotivate me or distract me from, as I say, what I've been doing since 2014, which is showing you the truth, reporting what is going on from here in Donbass. We'll continue to do that today. Have done a full day of reportage from Severodonetsk, and I'm really looking forward to getting some subtitles on that. getting that up for you to see and getting the truth out there, because there is a film which many of you will be aware of in Russian called Brat Brother, and it says that whoever side the truth is on, that person is more powerful. And I know that truth is on our side, and the actions of the other side, which is the UK government, Liz Truss, tell you that they can't handle, to reference the channel The Spirit of Jack Nicholson a few good men, they can't handle the truth, so they have to resort to the tactics of a mafia state to try and eliminate the truth, to try and exterminate the truth.
So that's the voice of Graham Phillips speaking this week, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, the attack upon independent journalists, because there's a German woman journalist that's also had similar things done to her by the German government. It's because they don't like to, you know, the narrative which they want to present about all of this is fundamentally wrong, and they really don't like people pointing out the holes in it. But you can see there are straws in the wind that they're beginning to realise that they can't win, and they're trying to create some, the total wall of propaganda starts to break down when certain, you know, things like this missile strike on the prison. You know, the people have been given a very partial history of what happened here. I mean, and one of the things that's very revealing, of course, is the way that they always use the word, the unprovoked Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yes, now, and the sovereign country of Ukraine.
Yes, that's right. But I mean, you know, Serbia was a sovereign country and Kosovo was part of it. But NATO went to war to prise it from their control. Incidentally, that situation is also deteriorating as we speak. And you sometimes think, to talk to mainstream politicians in Britain, what is your position on Nagorno-Karabakh? Should the Armenians have it, or should the Azerbaijanis been allowed to establish control over their own territory? These kinds of conflicts are actually endemic around the world, but in this particular conflict in the Ukraine, we're given a totally one-sided view of what's happened and who's done what to whom. And of course, the Ukrainian side has been extremely brutal. Before the ceasefire in 2014. You know, at least 14,000 people had died, and possibly more. And that's Russian-speaking civilians, mostly. Okay, but so you'd look for that in vain in the prognostications of mainstream politicians in Britain.
Before we go to have a look, yeah, particularly in the Labour Party.
Well, it's not just in the Labour Party, it's across the spectrum.
No, but Martin, if Robin Cook was still alive, this is exactly what sort of thing he'd be saying, isn't it?
Well, if Robin Cook was still alive, maybe we wouldn't be in this mess. Instead, we've got Liz Truss as our foreign secretary, which is, you know, there's no comparison there.
Yeah, really. But I mean, he was extremely good. Now, look, the Taliban on Thursday, before we look at Taiwan and Pelosi, announced it's investigating the US claim that al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri was killed in a CIA drone strike in Kabul. It said it wasn't aware of his presence in the Afghan capital. The spokesman, Zabiullah Mujahid, said the Taliban, Mujahid, well, it sounds like a Mujahideen, doesn't he? Yeah. Said the Taliban-led government, known formerly as the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, had no information about his arrival and stay in Kabul. The leadership of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan instructed the investigation and intelligence agencies to conduct an investigation into the aspects of this incident. So although the Americans have said that Zawahiri was in Kabul and have killed him, supposedly, in a drone strike, the Taliban are saying no, he didn't die at all. Well, they're questioning the whole thing.
Well, yes. I mean, when the Americans come out with something like this, I mean, how many times have they killed various so-called al-Qaeda leaders? And there's been research done, you know, the same guy pops up again and said, oh, we've killed him. Well, we didn't get him the first time. That was a lie. But we did get him the second time. Al-Qaeda itself was created by British, American and Saudi intelligence in the 1980s. So it may be that he was there and they managed to catch him and whack him. It's probably got an awful lot more to do with the November elections coming up in the US.
Well, yeah, also,
and
I mean,
of course, the fact that the Americans and the British had to run away from Afghanistan with their tails between their legs this time last year. So this is all PR stuff by the West, isn't it?
It looks on the surface as though they've killed somebody else and they've just said it's this guy.
Well, it could be. It could be that it is this guy. I don't know. But I don't believe anything they say. It certainly wasn't the case that they killed bin Laden in Pakistan. If you talk to any Pakistani shopkeepers or taxi drivers in Bristol, they just laugh when they hear that. Bin Laden's been dead for years. But, of course, the whole idea of him is very important. It's like, you know, a man down the ship shop swears he's Elvis. It's a way of keeping the whole thing alive, of creating an image of the powerful leaders of the West doing these important things. There isn't actually a legal basis. Let's just make this clear. There is no legal basis whatsoever for you to fly a drone into Afghanistan to kill somebody at random. You can't. You're not supposed to do that. And of course, the drone had to overfly Pakistan. And it's quite possible that if Imran Khan had still been the prime minister of Pakistan, he would have simply forbidden them to do that. So the current government in Pakistan are in the spotlight here, because a lot of people in Pakistan are asking, well, who allowed them to do that?
OK, so let's have a look at Taiwan and Nancy Pelosi's, well, not such a surprise visit. She was threatening to go there. Apparently, this is connected with this massive amount of money going from the US Senate and the US government into microchips. And I don't know why Pelosi has to go, why she can't do a Zoom call or something. Although maybe the Chinese would be able to listen into that. And maybe that's why she thinks she has to go. But Martin, it's caused all sorts of a fuss and a kerfuffle, hasn't it?
It has. And I think you mentioned microchips there. One of the things that the Chinese government have done in response to this is they've cut off supplies of a certain kind of sand to Taiwan. And this sand, in fact, is a crucial component of producing microchips.
Well, yeah, the other thing they've done is to launch the largest ever drills near Taiwan.
Yep.
ASEAN, the military alliance around that part of the world, has urged the US, China and China to lower tensions over in Taiwan. In the States, Senator Menendez has called for a major overhaul of US policy towards Taiwan as a result of all of this. And antiwar.com is telling us that Chinese trade bans on Taiwan risk deeper predicament. So it looks as if it might end up for the Taiwanese, this being a rather, well, in fact, there's a cartoon I was retweeting, I think, or sharing on Telegram or something earlier on, either today or yesterday, showing Pelosi parachuting in to Taiwan from a US Air Force jet with her body wrapped in explosives, like a suicide belt, basically, that she was about to blow up when she landed.
Well, it's the Chinese made their position clear, because nobody this senior has been to Taiwan for years. The last person as senior as this, I understand, was what's his name? He was involved in, he's a senior senator, it'll come to me in a minute, the name of him, but he had been to Beijing first. Yeah, this is the guy that was a prisoner in Vietnam. You know the guy I'm talking about?
Oh, John McCain,
that's right. He went to Taiwan as a visitor, as part of the government that he was part of, but he'd been to Beijing first, and so they kind of overlooked it. This has been a deliberate provocation of the Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, well, by going to Beijing first,
there's no need to provoke them.
Well, that's
and
right. Back
into Taiwan
first,
itself, Martin, a lot of, they've done opinion polls. I mean, a lot of people are not very happy about this, because it's created a conflict that wasn't necessarily going to blow
first,
up, but now it will.
Let's just spell this out. By going to Beijing first, McCain has made it clear that this is part of an agreement amongst diplomats, amongst mature adults.
Well, he's not well known. He was not well known for being a diplomat. But the point is, because he'd been to Beijing first.
He wouldn't have been able to do that unless he'd arranged it with the help of Chinese and US diplomats. So, you know, this is what's changed, I think, in the intervening years.
Well, that's right, because they're doing this. Pelosi is doing it because it's about to do, she wants to win votes in the Chinese expatriate community in San Francisco, where that's where her electoral district is. And it's also the Democrats are trying to warmonger the Republicans. And once they said that they were going to go, she said she was floating the idea that she was going to go. The Pentagon then said, well, please don't, because it's going to cause a problem. And then it was not clear whether she was going to go or not. But the Republicans were licking their lips because they knew that if she didn't go, they could accuse her of not standing up to the Chinese. And if she did go, it would provoke a conflict with the Chinese, which is what they want anyway. And I think both the Chinese and Russian governments are rapidly coming to the conclusion that there's no sensible dialogue to be had with the Western powers. And, you know, that means that they're going to do what they want, what they're going to do. And they're not going to listen to what the West says because they don't take them seriously.
Yeah, it's almost
you're just provoking us for the hell of it.
A bit of an infantile diplomatic approach. But anyway, that's where we
see it is infantile, but it's very dangerous.
It is.
The Chinese basically are very cautious. So they wouldn't want to escalate things unnecessarily. But if you go publicly tweak their nose, they feel they've got to do something. Otherwise, people will think that they're weak. Yes. Which is really stupid, but well, there actually, you are.
They are most definitely not weak, are they? Anyway, every Thursday in Vauxhall at something called the Tea House Theatre, every Thursday evening, the first Thursday of the month, not every Thursday, the first Thursday of the month, they have a thing called Keep On Talking. And this is a discussion group which includes all sorts of interesting speakers, some a bit dull, some not. Last night I went along and they had a rather tedious session where everything was being translated into Spanish as it went, which, from a production point of view, is a complete disaster because you've only basically got you're boring people for half the time. You just have something in English. And they actually had some people live from Moscow on Zoom as part of the meeting, which, I mean, obviously they're more likely to speak English than they are to speak Spanish. So why Spanish was involved, God only knows. But so it wasn't very well run, but interesting anyway. And some very interesting people came along to that. One of them was this young woman called Dana, who is 23-year-old from Ukraine. And we're going to hear from her now about what she's doing here over in the UK and what she made of this meeting, which was looking at basically Putin as some kind of hero. And how does that make her feel? She goes along to a meeting in London where there are lots of fingers being pointed, not at Putin, but at the West.
My name is Lena. I'm from Ukraine. I used to live in Kiev, but I moved to London 4 months ago because of the invasion.
Okay, so you're at a meeting here where we're hearing that maybe Putin is right to invade Ukraine.
Yeah, it makes me super angry because, I mean, my people die. And he just cannot be right because at first it's not human. And the reason that he says why he invaded Ukraine, they just don't make any sense. Because they, at least he says that Ukraine bombed Donbas. That isn't true. And then he says that we were, you know, making bad things to Russians. And it's also not true because me as Ukrainian, I used to speak Russian 6 months ago in Kiev. And it was okay. So the reason why he invaded, I think, is a bit bigger, and we don't really know what is the real reason, because what he says, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Kiev is supposed to be relatively peaceful, so maybe you can stay there.
I feel like there is no safe space in Ukraine. There is no safe space, because they random bombed different cities, and we don't know when they are going to bomb Kiev another time. No one is safe and no one is protected there. And still, there is Russian aggression, but also the situation isn't stable. And we don't really know what can happen. Are they going to be terror acts or some other things? We don't know.
Well, what Putin says is it's a demilitarization, it's a denazification, it's not an invasion.
There were no Nazis, and military in Ukraine existed not to, you know, not to invade other country, but to be able to protect ourselves. That's it.
So for young people here, what was it like growing up in Ukraine? Was it similar to London? You've been here a little while now.
I would say that I'm 23, but I grew up as a Soviet Union kid, and my grandma told me stories that Russian and Ukraine are sisters, are brothers, and I really believed it. And for example, when people ask me, are you from Russia? I would be like, yeah, from like, no, I'm from Ukraine, but we are Russians. So I identified myself close to Russians as well. Not anymore. It's changed because they started killing us, you know, so that's why.
OK, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So that's Dana, spoke to last night at the Keep On Talking party, which they take place on the first Thursday of every month at the Tea House Theatre in Vauxhall, which is quite near to Vauxhall Tube Station, which was great fun last night because there was a match at the Oval and there were thousands of people there. But we had a very interesting evening. And, you know, there's an open mic, so people get a chance to put their point of view, as I was asked to last night, which was lovely. But one of the main reasons I was there, it was to talk to the former British ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, about the situation with Pelosi and Taiwan, but also about many other matters. Several other matters to do with world affairs, about the power of diplomats, and also about the Tory leadership race. So here's Peter Ford now speaking to me last night at the Tea House Theatre in Vauxhall.
Peter Ford. I was in the diplomatic service for 35 years, ended up ambassador in Syria, before that ambassador in Bahrain, and I previously worked in Singapore at one point. So I am familiar with East Asia.
Right. Now, I'm fascinated by what's happening with Taiwan. The Mint Press News had a fascinating cartoon which we circulated to our listeners last week on email, and it showed a picture of Uncle Sam lying on Ukraine, pouring petrol on the flames with a giant telescope, with at the end of the telescope a little island called Taiwan. We've seen since then, we've seen over the last week, this visit by Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. Actually, it's just a diplomatic move, it seems. Why have the Chinese got so irate about this?
Well, the situation over Taiwan is dramatic, but not serious, I would say. Dramatic, but not serious. Now, that sounds strange. Nancy Pelosi has seen fit to dramatize a situation that was bubbling away, but relatively quiescent. And she's done that for nakedly domestic political reasons, maneuvering in U.S. domestic politics. Of course, the Chinese have got upset because it represents or potentially represents a step towards the recognition by America of the independence of Taiwan. And this is absolute anathema to the Chinese, who regard Taiwan with some reason as part of China. And America itself, like the rest of Western countries, does not recognize, has never recognized Taiwan as anything other than as part of China. But what the West says is that the status of Taiwan in terms of its autonomy remains to be decided. So any step like a visit by the Speaker of the American House of Representatives is a dramatic step and looks like a step towards recognition of the independence of Taiwan. But I say the situation is dramatic but not serious because I don't believe that China wants war.
Well, nobody wants war until it happens. And I'm afraid there are people that do want war, not necessarily the states, we hope, but there are all sorts of arms firms, companies, resource companies, oil companies that actually rather do like war because they can grab resources or they can make money out of war. But what, how do you think that this would be going down amongst diplomats here in London and in Washington, Nancy Pelosi's visit? How do you think it will go down? Do you think they think this is the right thing to do? And do they have much autonomy, or do diplomats nowadays just have to do what they're told?
Well, it's diplomats who call the shots effectively, and this is a matter of doctrine, whether to recognize Taiwan as independent. And even the sainted Donald Trump, who is not averse to making striking radical moves, hesitated, listened to the advice of the professional diplomats about the recognition of Taiwan. These matters of doctrine are sometimes extremely important. But you mentioned the economy and commercial interests. The interesting thing here is that China would hesitate to invade Taiwan precisely for commercial reasons. Now, this may surprise you, but China is dependent on Taiwan for its supply of semiconductors. So is the West. We're both in hock to Taiwan over semiconductors. So
surely the Chinese might think, well, we can take all that supply over and make the money ourselves.
I don't think they'd make that calculation, because it would be extremely difficult to take over Taiwan. Surely the Ukraine conflict has demonstrated the risks of being complacent about the abilities of a big power just to walk into a neighboring territory and take it over. There's also geography. Taiwan is an island. It's very difficult to mount a seaborne series of landings, and apparently there are only 11 potential sites, beaches, where a seaborne landing could be carried out. China would be risking its own Bay of Pigs. And I suspect that what happened in Kiev at the beginning, Kiev at the beginning of the Ukraine conflict will have reminded the Chinese of the risks of being overconfident.
What about the opposite? What about the Chinese looking at Moscow, looking at Russia, and thinking to themselves, well, hang on, they've done quite well over there. They've managed to actually take NATO on, and they're winning. Isn't this likely to give China more confidence?
Well, I think it will give China pause, food for thought. The Ukraine operation has not been the walkover that many of us expected, myself included. And it's down to geography. Ukraine is huge. It's three or four times the size of the UK. The territory that Russia has established control over is as big as Wales, plus the north of England, plus East Anglia. So it's already been a major, major military operation. But the idea that Russia could walk over the whole of Ukraine has proven to be an illusion. But China will is always historically very cautious country. They look before they leap. They will be reading the lessons of Ukraine, and I suspect that in some ways the lessons will incline them towards caution. But in another way, it will encourage them, the way Western sanctions on Russia backfired on the West. Now, who'd have expected that? But I'm sure the Chinese will be drawing the conclusion that the West is adept at shooting itself in the foot.
Okay, a final question just about the so-called cost of living crisis here, because as you've just alluded to, we have with the Bank of England literally this week is just saying we're going up to, I think, is it 1.75% interest rates? It looks as if, and that actually could even fuel more inflation here. We've got a potential winter of discontent coming, an autumn of discontent with strikes where people are saying, well, look, we can no longer afford to feed our families on full-time income. So we have a situation now quite clearly happening already, not just looming for those, you know, in like the rail workers, where work is no longer a route out of poverty. So quite clearly this is going to cause trouble here. So what do you think is the root of this, at the root of this, and how do we fix it?
This country is in total denial about the roots of the wave of inflation. It's in denial about the impact of lockdown, how unnecessary lockdown was, how inflationary it was for 2 years to put the economy into an induced coma, how inflation stoking it was to pay people for 2 years to sit on their backsides doing nothing. We're in denial about all that. That is seen as a good thing. Look, people are praising Sunak for having paid people salaries to do nothing. We're also in denial about the impact of that other conscious decision we took to sanction Russia. We must not be surprised if now it bites us on the ankle. Russia is retaliating, as it's entitled to do, by withdrawing supplies or threatening to withdraw supplies of gas to Europe. This is stoking the energy crisis and therefore the inflation crisis. And again, as with lockdown, these were conscious decisions that our elites took. And not just the Tory government, but with the full support of Labour. And so all of them are in denial, and they don't want people to realize what are the real causes of this inflation.
So what do we do?
What do we do is try to educate people. I'm not very...
No, so if you were a chancellor, what would you do? I mean, there must be something we can do in order to sort of start, at least begin to fix the problem, to set ourselves back on the right track again. Annoying to use a railway analogy there, but, you know, that's where we need to be. How do we get back on track?
There are some voices, even people you wouldn't expect, who are now calling for peace negotiations over Ukraine. This is not politically impossible, I would say. There's a growing trend towards the obvious. In the end, we've tried everything, and then in the end, we'll do the obvious right thing of trying to work for peace in Ukraine. That will help. In the meanwhile, what will help is to stop making the situation worse by pumping arms into Ukraine.
I said final question, but what about the Tory leadership race? Are you following it? And do you think it matters who wins? Who do you think might win?
You're asking me if I would prefer cancer or heart disease, Tony. I'm not enthused by either of them. But there was a telling moment for me when Sunak was being interviewed about the alleged climate emergency. And he said, well, I take my advice on this subject from my teenage daughters. Well, if that's where we are, with the potential prime minister being advised on the most important question of the day by his teenage daughters, well, God forbid it's Sunak.
Peter Ford, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, so that's the former ambassador to Syria, Britain's former ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, speaking at the first Thursday of every month at the Tea House Theatre in Vauxhall, this Keep On Talking event. I always think it's quite nice to go along to these things just to sort of spot the spooks and see if you can see people who are trying to sort of mess around with the situation and steer people in the wrong direction. But anyway, like I say, it's perfectly good and valid thing to do. Just you've got to watch yourself, I suppose. But if they do an open mic, as they invited me a couple of times to speak last night, I have absolutely no reservations about giving them a good old plug. If you're in London on the first Thursday of any month, go and pop down to the Tea House Theatre in Vauxhall and keep in touch with them, I think, on email. Although one person who was there was telling me, oh, they promised me several times they'd add me to the email list, but they never did. So I wondered whether they didn't really want me to come. So that's the sort of thing, you've got these big question marks hanging over groups like this, you know, to what extent they are controlled. Anyhow. Martin, what do you make of all of that? We also, of course, the lady we heard from, Dana, before about Ukraine, particularly about this connection with, or not connection with, and just how dodgy the whole business in Taiwan is.
Well, obviously, you had quite a lot wide-ranging conversation with Peter Ford there. So, you know, you'd have to, you know, focusing on Ukraine and Taiwan. I broadly agree with what he said about those topics. The Ukrainians.
So that Taiwan effectively is quite a lot of saber rattling going on here.
Well, yes. I mean, there's no reason to make this into it's in the US. There is a determination to confront the Chinese and the Russians. If you listen to the internal US debate, and of course the debate here in the leadership contest, both candidates are competing to be more Russophobic, more Sinophobic. It's an insane.
Well, in a way, the most important point he made there was saying, well, actually, this is really for US domestic consumption, and the fact that it might be affecting world peace doesn't seem to really matter much.
Well, that's the problem, is the narcissism of the West, where they just presume that what we want is what they want is what matters, and everybody else has just got to knuckle under and accept it. And of course. Both modern China and modern Russia have gone out of their way to try and accommodate what the West wants to do. So they've done their best to try and fit in and be team players. And it's just a waste of time because they're never going to be accepted. And I think the conclusion has been drawn by both of them. And the Indians are sitting on the fence now, whereas once they were pretty firmly in the Western camp. I think Modi and the right wing in India are starting to see which way the wind's blowing. And that's happening all over the world. It's very dangerous because miscalculation here it could easily lead to something that nobody actually wants, because people in the West are not really competent to handle things at this level.
Okay.
As a little for instance, Ben Wallace, our defense secretary, used to be a captain in the Scots Guards, and one of the things he said, well, the Scots Guards kicked the Russians backside in the 1850s in the Crimean War, and I'm sure we can do it again. It's like, you're in charge. What sort of an attitude is that? And of course it's absolutely wrong. You know, it's just not the case that Britain is in a position to take on Russia militarily at all. And if we try, we'll find out that we're not.
Well, yeah, I mean, this sort of boasting in military terms is
stupid.
Really not helpful, is it? Anyway, before we go on to other things, let's just check out Yuval Noah Harari and his take on Ukraine. And afterwards, we'll hear Dr. Vladimir Zelenko from a couple of weeks ago giving his point of view of Harari. Martin, you've read some of his stuff. You were saying you read his stuff over the lockdowns. And his little strap line, if you want, is humans are hackable animals. What did you make of what you read? Which books did you read of his?
Well, I read one called Sapiens, which is about a sort of history of human civilization, and there's another one, I can't remember the name of that, which is about, you know, the future of human civilization.
So he takes, I guess, a sort of humanist evolutionary take on it all, does he?
Well, you know, a lot of it is, you know, I'm willing to come, you know, to engage with the ideas, but of course what's extraordinary, I'll bet you we're going to find it on what he says about what I've seen about him saying about Ukraine, is what he said to the Germans is, as an Israeli, you know, we don't mind you going to war now, because if you're fighting for the right things against the Russians, then that's good. So we don't really want to, you know, so don't, you know, Germans, you can rearm. And as an Israeli, I'm happy for you to rearm. Now, that's got nothing to do with the topic of his books, but it shows you where he's ultimately coming from.
It does. I mean, it's a little bit nervous. Anyway, is there anything particularly that you got from the Sapiens book? Anything that sticks in your mind?
Well, I mean, what he's talking about is the idea that, you know, we are becoming very, you know, the artificial intelligence and surveillance capitalism are now becoming extremely powerful forces. And he's pointing out that, you know, the idea that people, you know, that corporations and governments are able to predict human behavior and make people do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. And in its more liberal manifestation, he is raising the issues that this causes, and he doesn't have any solutions. He just said, well, these are the issues we're going to have to deal with. But on the other hand, I think he is actually when it comes down to it, a bit of a cheerleader for these changes rather than somebody who's just pointing them out. So it'll be interesting to see what he's got to say about Ukraine, because I think that's a very good indication of whether people have got the plot or not. And it sounds to me that he hasn't.
It sounds a bit like Minority Report. You know, the film about predicting, isn't it? I think it's to do with a sort of special police department that predicts. I did watch it back in the day. I think it was the early noughties. Just looking it up, 2002 it was, where what you've got is it's based on a Philip K. Dick novel in the year 2054. Where pre-crime, a specialised police department, apprehends criminals based on foreknowledge provided by psychics called precogs. So they're saying that, you know, you can use psychics to see who's going to do what, and you can arrest them before they get a chance to do it. Now, this is actually a bit like what he's saying there, science fiction.
Well, yeah, except that there's more. This isn't psychics. I mean, it is the case that, you know, the social media companies are able to see how to feed stuff in that will generate a certain effect. And they've got more power to do this than they've ever had before. And you can see this around the Ukraine war. There's massive PR operation that's gone on to make Zelensky into this kind of anti-hero rebel figure. People are having their buttons pressed. They don't really know anything much about the Ukraine, but they think they do. In their minds, they've got a full picture of what's going on. But of course, they haven't. They've got a very partial picture. And a lot of it is actually been crafted by psychological warfare officers. But they don't realize that.
Yeah. Just as an example of that, I think you're absolutely right. I can remember, is it David Livingstone, his article on his Ordo Ab Chao website. I think it's about time we had another interview with him, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, a Canadian Muslim. He pointed out, Martin, that Facebook was targeting QAnon adverts towards those interested in alternative health, resulting in what academics has identified as conspirituality, a strange blend, he says, of New Age movement and right-wing conspiracy theories. So they have a whole kind of armory of the QAnon, for example, which is then being used to undermine and pollute the thinking of people who are concerned about alternative health during the COVID pandemic.
Well, look, there's a huge amount of conflict going on and all sorts of different ideas about what these conflicts are about. And there's also a huge, you know, strong vested interest who believe in this idea of trying to mould popular opinion, and that they can mould popular opinion. This was always true. Societies have always had kind of rumours and false ideas and so on. The technology makes it that much more immediate.
Social media has made this, almost formalised this whole thing. Livingstone says the merger of these seemingly paradoxical influences can be traced back to, he says, David Icke, who has introduced into conventional conspiracy theories a blend of New Age and theosophical ideas, which have long had a close relationship with fascism and in particular Nazism. So, you know, I'll put a link up again, I think, to the at least I'll use the opening paragraph of this conspiracy. He calls it the conspiracy. The article's entitled David Icke, Fascism and Conspirituality. So the idea is just trying to sort of spiritually hijack the conspiracy theory or truth movement using these particularly targeted ads. But anyway, look, let's get back to Yuval Noah Harari and see what he has to say about the war in Ukraine. And thank you, Martin, very much for that little précis of some of the interesting points that were that he was making in his Sapiens book. Means that I don't have to bother to read it, thank God. So let's have a listen to Yuval Noah Harari, and we'll hear afterwards from Vladimir Zelenko about who he thinks he really is and on the war in Ukraine and how it could change everything.
The most crucial thing to know is that Ukrainians are not Russians and that Ukraine is an ancient independent nation. Ukraine has a history of more than 1,000 years. Kyiv was a major metropolis and cultural center when Moscow was not even a village. For most of these 1,000 years, Kyiv was not ruled by Moscow. They were not part of the same political entity. For centuries, Kyiv was looking westwards and was a part of a union with Lithuania and Poland until it was eventually conquered and absorbed by the Russian Empire, by the Tsarist Empire. But even after that, Ukrainians remained a separate people to a large extent. And it's important to know that because this is really what is at stake in this war. The key issue of the war, at least for President Putin, is whether Ukraine is an independent nation, whether it is a nation at all. He has this fantasy that Ukraine isn't a nation, that Ukraine is just a part of Russia, that Ukrainians are Russians. In his fantasy, Ukrainians are Russians that want to be back in the fold of Mother Russia, and that the only ones preventing it is a very small gang at the top, which he portrays as Nazis, even if the president is Jewish, but okay, a Nazi Jew. And his belief was, at least, that he just needs to invade. Zelensky will flee. The government will collapse. The army would lay down its arms. And the Ukrainian people would welcome the Russian liberators, throwing flowers on them. And this fantasy has been shattered already. Zelensky hasn't fled. The Ukrainian army is fighting. And the Ukrainian people is not throwing flowers on the Russian tanks. It's throwing Molotov cocktails. We did see in the last 30 years Ukrainians twice rising in revolt when there was a danger of an authoritarian regime being established, once in 2004, once in 2013. And when I was in Kyiv a few years ago, what really struck me was this very strong feeling of the desire for independence and for democracy. And I remember walking around this museum of the revolution of 2013-2014 and seeing these images, like these two elderly women who were bringing sandwiches to the demonstrators, to the fighters. They couldn't throw stones and they couldn't do anything else, so they prepared sandwiches and brought this huge tray full of sandwiches to the demonstrators. And this is the kind of spirit that inspires not just the Ukrainians, but everybody who is now watching what is happening there.
Help me understand the actual nature of the threat here in terms of Russia moving into Ukraine.
The imperial dream was always there, but you know, empires are often the creation of a very small gang of people at the top. I don't think the Russian people is interested in this war. I don't think that the Russian people wants to conquer Ukraine or to slaughter the citizens of Kyiv. It's all coming from the top. So there is no change there. I mean, when you look at the Soviet Union, you can say that there was this mass ideology, which was shared by a large proportion or some proportion of the population. You don't see this now. You know, Russia is a very rich country, rich in resources, but most people are very poor. Their standard of living is very, very low because all the wealth and power is kind of sucked by the people at the top, and very little is left for everybody else. So it's not, I don't think it's a society where the masses are part of this kind of ideological project. They are being ruled from the top. And you have this classic imperial situation when the emperor, which controls the largest country in the world, feels that, hey, this is not enough. I need more. And sends his army to capture, to extend the empire.
I said at the beginning that it's difficult, of course, to make provisions. But yesterday you published an article in The Guardian titled, "Why Putin Has Already Lost This War." Please explain.
Well, one thing should be very clear. I don't mean to say that he's going to suffer an immediate military defeat. He definitely has the military power to conquer Kyiv and perhaps the whole of Ukraine. Unfortunately, we might see this. But his long-term goal, the whole rationale of the war, is to deny the existence of the Ukrainian nation and to absorb it into Russia. And to do that, it's not enough to conquer Ukraine. You also need to hold it. And it's all based on this fantasy, on this gamble, that most of the population in Ukraine would agree to this, would even welcome this. And we already know that it's not true, that the Ukrainians are a very real nation. They are fiercely independent. They don't want to be part of Russia. They will fight like hell. And in the long run, again, you can conquer a country. But as the Russians learned in Afghanistan, as the Americans learned also in Afghanistan, also in Iraq, it's much harder to hold a country. And again, you know, the big question mark before the war was always this. Before the war started, many things were already known. Everybody knew that the Russian army is much stronger than the Ukrainian army. Everybody knew that NATO will not send armed forces into Ukraine, troops into Ukraine. Everybody knew that the West, the Europeans, would be hesitant about imposing too strict a sanction regime for fear of being hurt by it themselves. And this was the basis for Putin's war plan. But there was one big unknown. Nobody could say for sure how the Ukrainian people would react. And there was always the option that maybe Putin's fantasy would come true. Maybe the Russians will march in, Zelensky would flee, maybe the Ukrainian army would just capitulate and the population would not do much. This was always an option. And now we know this was just fantasy. Now we know that the Ukrainians are fighting, they will fight. And this derails the whole rationale of Putin's war. Because you can conquer the country maybe, but you won't be able to absorb Ukraine back into Russia. The only thing he's accomplishing, he's planting seeds of hatred in the hearts of every Ukrainian being killed. Every day this war continues is more seeds of hatred that may last for generations. The Ukrainians and Russians didn't hate each other before Putin. They're siblings. Now he's making them enemies. And if he continues, this will be his legacy.
Well, that's Yuval Noah Harari there, speaking back in February, just after the Russian invasion. Martin, what do you make of his analysis?
Well, it's just flat out wrong. He's retailing the usual story that we get from the pro-Western media. And I feel like saying to him, yes, the Palestinians in Israel, they're a real nation as well. And they're never going to give up until the state of Israel is kicked out of the region. And of course, he would dispute that and say, well, no, there's two sides to it. Well, there's two sides to the Ukrainian crisis as well. And of course, we know which side he's on. It's very clear. So, you know, whatever liberal, he's regarded as some kind of a liberal. But I mean, there are plenty of liberals like him who come out with that sort of nonsense. Ukraine has never been an independent state before 1991. There is no such thing as the Ukrainian language. It's actually Ruthenian. Ukraine is just a word that means the borderland. In actual fact, Yugoslavia had a much more solid existence as a state. It was created at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, but that broke up. And Ukraine is a much more fragile creature than that. The Russian speakers in the east of Ukraine were never happy to be in a state labeled Ukraine. They don't speak Ukrainian, for example. They speak Russian. These are the kind of conflicts like in Nagorno-Karabakh, or dare I say it, Israel-Palestine, Sri Lanka with the Tamil Tigers and all the rest of it. He's just riding one pro-Western point of view on all of this. And it's not surprising that he's an academic in Israel, which, as we discussed earlier, is an imperialist creation.
But Martin, look, he's pointed out, and something you can't argue against, really, is that both in 2013 and in 2004, the Ukrainian people did what they could to wrest themselves away from Russia and much more towards the West and the EU.
Well, what happened? Ukrainian politics from 1991 onwards was a balancing act between the pro-Western forces in the West Ukraine and the pro-Russian forces in the East Ukraine. And the two factions were very evenly balanced. And ultimately, they had to find some way of not being on anybody's side so that Ukraine could be independent. And when Kuchma was in charge in that era, the Ukrainians were pursuing a genuinely neutral policy where it was clearly Ukraine has got two choices. Ultimately, it's either a bridge or a battleground. But what it's become is a battleground because the West, the coup in 2014 was carried out on the back of a massacre carried out by a NATO despot.
Martin, we hear loads about that, but we don't hear about the Ukrainians' attempt to join the West.
No, in 2004, there was something called the Orange Revolution, which was funded by Berezovsky, based in Britain, and very colour revolution, and then pro-Western politicians came to power. But they messed up. The Ukrainian economy has been completely messed up. So when Yuval Harari is going on about how the Russian economy, the wealthy do very well and the poor are poor, well, that, you know, the reason for that, that was because of the West's imposition of structural adjustment policies in the 1990s. Every Russian and every Ukrainian knows that the reason why they're poor is not because they used to live in the Soviet Union. It's because they've pursued these ridiculously super free market policies in the interests of foreign interests. And that's why they're poor. And of course, what Putin's done in Russia is he's turned that round a bit. The Ukrainian oligarchs like Kolomoisky is now in Israel. Most of the top Ukrainian oligarchs, just as in Russia, were actually Jewish and have got Israeli passports.
Well, I mean, it's also worth pointing out Viktor Pinchuk, who owns, I think it's called the Grand Hotel in Trafalgar Square. He isn't in Israel. He's very much definitely in Ukraine and Israel. And he is... Well, he's one of the wealthiest people in the country, and he's one of the guys who financed through his Masonic Lodge, being master of the Masonic Lodge, and controlled the 2014 coup. So these,
yes, and it was a coup as well. I mean, this presentation, this was a rebellion against the repressive government. It was the elected government. Supported more in the East Ukraine than the West Ukraine. Yeah. The Western Ukrainians weren't very happy about having Yanukovych as the prime minister or the president, but they were outvoted.
Anyway,
Yanukovych agreed with the demonstrators, all right, we'll have an early election to settle this then. But there wasn't an election. There was just a takeover by far-right groups, and they were far-right groups as well. Yeah. The idea that there are no Nazis on the right wing in Ukraine, it's stupid. I mean, in Yugoslavia, it was pretty clear that right-wing Croatians were crypto-fascists.
I think it's
clear the whole Serbian population out of Ukraine.
Martin, this has been NATO's policy in Ukraine and the CIA's policy as to being in all of the key security and military positions to make sure that those neo-Nazis are in those jobs so that they can be easily
actual history of it is Zelensky was elected rather than Poroshenko, who's another Jewish oligarch. He was definitely for war. He was saying, we want to go to war. Let's go. We're going to take back the breakaway republics. We're going to take back Crimea. He lost the election because quite a lot of Russian speakers thought we're not going to vote for that. And they voted for Zelensky because Zelensky promised that he would negotiate with the Russians and bring the war to an end. He then tried to do that. He went down to the front line in the Donbass and tried to speak to the right wing nutcases. And they said, don't even think about it. If you try and make peace, we're going to kill you. He then went back to Kiev, as they call it nowadays. He phoned up his Western handlers and said, look, I'm trying to negotiate with the Russians, but my right wing won't let me. Will you back me up to face them down? And they said, no, we don't want you to negotiate with the Russians. The British in particular, behind the scenes, have been saying all along, no negotiations, no negotiations, no negotiations. Whereas the French and the Germans were hinting that maybe that was the way to go. So the presentation of all of this is just completely tendentious. And of course, the idea that the Russians were just going to walk in and take over the Ukraine, that was never their plan in the first place. They've never intended to take over the whole of the Ukraine. They intend to liberate those areas which did not want to be part of the Ukraine. And that probably will include Odessa, I'm afraid, where the Odessa massacre was carried out by right-wing paramilitaries on pro-Russian demonstrators who were all burned to death in the trade union hall. Nobody was ever prosecuted for any of that. The shootings in the Maidan Square at the beginning. We've had a 2018 court case in Kiev. That was carried out by snipers from Georgia, orchestrated by an American officer. That's what caused the war. And of course, people like Yuval Hariri, I would say there are two things possible. Either he doesn't know all the things I've just said, and it's quite possible that he doesn't, because people are ignorant, or he does know, in which case he's evil.
Well, he's
and
been,
I think that's the problem.
Well, he's been suggested he's connected to the Mossad as well. But anyway, look, from Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, to Zelenko, Vladimir Zelenko, Dr. Vladimir Zelenko. Here he is. On a recording made just before he died 3 weeks or so ago on what he calls and what he says they call the prophet. Of course, Dr. Vladimir Zelenko is an Orthodox Jewish doctor over in New York who brought about something called the Zelenko Protocol, which many wealthy and powerful people in the United States took on, which included the use of hydroxychloroquine in order to treat COVID rather than just to sort of sit there and do nothing or to use other products. So he was a very influential character for a few years, died recently. But here he is talking about what the guy you've just been hearing from. I think, on another level kind of analysis of him than you've just heard from Martin and I.
Yuval Noah Harari. Now, this is a bad boy. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about him. He is called the prophet by Klaus Schwab, Bill Gates, Zuckerberg, and Obama calls him his favorite author. He did it on CNN. So what does Yuval Noah Harari say? It's just one man, a little short guy. But he is messaging and influencing the thought patterns of the richest and most powerful people on the planet. So maybe we should know what he says. He says the following. This is a verbatim. Look it up. Humans are hackable animals. If you can hack an animal, you can engineer it with intelligent design, but not with some god intelligence above the clouds, but with human intelligent design. For we are now gods. There's no free will. There's no soul. And this is my favorite. COVID-19 will be an inflection point in history when 24/7 digital surveillance went under the skin. It's interesting. You know, in 2016, Klaus Schwab gave an interview on a French media platform. I saw it with subtitles. And he said something extremely puzzling. No one could figure it out. That in 10 years, by 2026, every single human being will be tagged with a digital identifier internally. So before I ask you why, I'd rather ask how. How do you logistically get 7 billion people to willingly get injected or implanted with some type of technology that allows for them to be surveilled? I have an idea. Mm-hmm. How about you manufacture a global crisis, create global fear, psychosis, then offer a false solution, which has nothing to do with COVID-19. Because if it did, why would we vaccinate 6-month-old children?
That's right.
According to the CDC, children have a 99.998% chance of recovery from COVID with no treatment. It's actually safer than the flu. There's no medical reason to inject them with something that is leaving the Sherman March as child's play compared to what this vaccine is doing. It's a carnage. Why would I inject that into a child? Not for medical reasons. There are other reasons, which we'll discuss. But one of them is to transition the world to a world of maximum control, surveillance, and in other words, slavery.
So there is Zev Zelenko's take on Yuval Noah Harari. And we'll wind up this week Martin, but I quite like the idea of over the over August, the silly season, as they call it, when we've got no government, no politics, nothing apparently, but of course the powers behind the scenes love this time of year to sort of cook stuff up. But for us, the kids are off, and it's nice to take them out to things like agricultural fairs. This is one of my favourites. Also to things like the Dorset Steam Fair, the famous Dorset Steam Fair, which is an absolute mega extravaganza. I think it runs over a couple of days at the end of this month. And the other thing is Heritage Railways, which I quite like because of the politics of railways. So we're going to wind up this week by hearing from the Spar Valley Railway, which is near Tunbridge Wells, or it just comes out of Tunbridge Wells near the Pantiles. And we had a little chug on there this week. And one of the people I spoke to was a chap called Jeff there. Now, Martin, in a way, a final comment from you. This whole business of transport is really crucial to me in the whole climate argument. There's very little talk about making sure that we can go back to a system of very efficient, socialist, state-run public transport that we had up until the Thatcher era. This was very good. In fact, actually, before that, I suppose, the age of the motorways, the building of the motorways by Marples Ridgeway, the transport minister at a road-building company, Beeching shut down the railways in the 1960s. So there was a deliberate attempt to shut down these networks, Martin, wasn't there, and to actually force people to get in, well, not force them, but to bribe people to get into nice, cheap cars with nice, cheap petrol.
Yes, and of course, if you make mistakes, you're path dependent. So just imagine what might have happened if we hadn't got rid of all the railways, or if they hadn't stripped out the tram systems in Eastern Europe when the Western invasion took place. The problem is once you've done all of these things, is then that you can't go back. But of course, railways are key to the Belt and Road Initiative, which is going to be linking Eurasia and the Chinese and the Russians certainly think of railways as the future.
Well, the fact of the matter is you can go back, you can relay trams as they've done in various places in Britain. It's just that they've kept it very, very, I mean, my attitude to all of this is of course common sense. It's very, very, the best way, the easiest way to get around, without having to buy a car, service a car, pay for a car, etc. And those that have got cars now are in hock to all sorts of parking, ULEZ, various like congestion charges, road pricing, basically. So every time you use the road, you're going to be charged on top of it. And it's a very easy way for governments to abuse their power and just charge people some tax for doing nothing and rake money in, increase the GDP for doing absolutely nothing. Anyway, so to this Spar Valley Railway now, and let's have a listen to Jeff a bit about it. I started chatting with him next to a diesel multiple unit, which was chugging away behind us, this big diesel engine, which obviously is a terrible polluter. But let's have a listen to Jeff now.
This is all built in the late 1950s. This one here for the sort of Oxted line. So they were used in a lot of the southern region areas where they weren't electrified, because obviously a lot of the southern region was third rail electrified, but there were certain rural lines that weren't, and these were built for that. So things like Ashford, Hastings, the East Grinstead, Oxted lines, some of the lines in Hampshire. This unit we've got here actually was the last unit to run on this line in 1985.
So this line wasn't shut by Beeching. Who was it shut by? This line closed, what, over 20 years after Beeching?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, Beeching was the main instigator of a lot of line closures, but post that, there were some other lines that were closed. There was a lot of rationalisation that went on. So this line was shut in 1985.
I have seen engines like this when I was growing up zooming past places like Grove Park from Hastings. Is this the same type of train? Because it's got this kind of square grille on the side of it, and it's a diesel, isn't it?
Yeah, they're the same design of train. The slight difference is the ones that used to run at Hastings were built to a very narrow gauge, because the tunnels through Tunbridge Wells and further on down to Hastings couldn't take full-size stock. because when that line was built, it was built on the cheap, and part of the tunnel lining collapsed, so they had to reline the tunnels, and consequently the stock that went through those tunnels had to be specially built to fit through.
Something a bit funny is going on with the railways, because we heard about, what was it, 20 years ago, that coal was on the out and it was bad for everybody. Now we're getting the same for diesel.
Yeah, I think environmentally we're realising what we're doing in some respects. Progression will move more towards electrification.
Yeah, but the trouble is, somewhere else, the electricity's being generated, isn't it? And possibly, I mean, even nuclear pollution.
Yeah, no, I'm fully with you on that. And I sometimes feel I'm the only person who worries about building more nuclear power stations.
So this diesel here, how does it actually connect to the power on the rail itself?
Right, okay, so obviously you've got a diesel engine we're standing next to it. It's got electric generators, which will then run all the electric traction inside the carriages and everything. And obviously the motor there is straight onto the bogie above it for propelling it.
Right. And what about this ticking noise? When we come into the station just back there, you stop and almost straight away underneath you can hear tick, tick, tick.
Yeah, it's because it's got electric generators underneath. So they were built, if you went on some of the old Southern Region electric units, they had very similar underneath. The electricity from the Third Rail would run the generators for the electrical supply and everything that was inside the carriages.
So that was separate to the power to drive the train. Okay, so what's happening with this one now? It's heading off, I imagine.
We're here for another 10 minutes and then we're back down to Erridge. This one has got a third coach which is still under restoration, so it's currently running as a two-car unit.
And if people want to come and visit, whereabouts can they go?
Right, so we run from Tunbridge Wells West here. We go through to, we've got a little station at High Rocks, which isn't open every day because we're dependent upon the pub there as to when we can open. And obviously we then go to Groombridge and Erridge. It's 5.5 mile trip.
Okay, thanks very much.
All right.
Thanks, Jeff.
You're welcome.
So that's Tunbridge Wells, the Spa Railway. Spa Valley Railway, that's right. Talking about the history of what happened there. And so I think over August we'll be having some more. I think possibly next week from the agricultural fairs, but I think it's nice to have a little bit of something a bit lighter. We used to do two shows a week, and now it's only the one. So I'm trying to slot in a few of these dialect, more lighter style pieces in during the month of August, which is, I think, you know, it's a bit of a light relief, really. And also, of course, it's ideas of places to go and issues that you can actually look at as you go. So time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thank you particularly to Peter Ford and Tony Greenstein, gave interviews this week. And also you can download this show, the MP3s, to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast. I've got some, actually one came in this morning, which I imagine is a bit too fast for me to turn it round for today. So that'll be in next week's show, hopefully, about the Soham murders. And you can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. My paperbacks about deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war, the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem, that's the Traitors of Arnhem, costs £15. That's actually a real paperback. And the Siege of Heaven Reader, just like that, is also there up on eBay. But the easiest way to get hold of all of those in their digital versions, the free digital, the paid for digital, and the paperback, is via www.bilderberg.org. Any problems getting hold of anything, just give me an email. At some point during the week, I should get hold of emails. I'm not all that good on email. The show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. No, we haven't at all. We've been actually remote in Herefordshire, in London and Bristol, streaming this show live. But it has been on the talkradio.org.uk stream and also at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. You will find the not the glorious BCFM Politics Show app. Well, it's actually, it doesn't say the glorious, so get rid of that. It's just not the BCFM Politics Show app. It's available free from all good app stores, which you can listen live. You can also download the show afterwards on that and the extended interviews. It's a pretty snazzy little thing. Well, you can do all sorts with that. And of course, you once the whole show is up and all the links, you can pick that up too on the app. Available free, as I say, from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in the UK today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, many of them, particularly The Guardian, who we're hearing about again there, and the glorious Fourth Reich. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Down and dirty, baby. Down and dirty, baby.